The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 334 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Money in the Bank Sunday, June 29, 2014. I am the Solid Monster. Tonight is the Money in the Bank pay-per-view from Boston, Massachusetts. We're going to get into some Money in the Bank predictions in just a bit. But first, I want to thank everybody who has been supporting the Sound Off. Audible, of course, the Audible trial still going on. Free 30-day trial you can sign up for right now. You get one free audiobook. I know a bunch of you guys did so this past week, so thank you for that. You can sign up at audibletrial.com/solomonster. And when you punch in that custom URL, you can browse around and sign up from there. It will register for our show, and it helps us out a little bit. So please consider doing that, or you can make a PayPal donation, as always, on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal box there. Have a bunch of shout-outs this week for people who have supported the Sound Off, including Antoine Moore, The Voice of Wrestling, Brad Gilmore, Chuck Lunatic Lentz, Adam the Maniac Misaglia, Chad Sucker Punch Sokolowski, Joshua Homicide Herman, The Boy Wonder, Shane Campany, Ravishing Rob Mace, The Fly Guy, J.W. Bridges, and Lord Have Mercy, Versy Jones. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. You're free to suggest your own nickname when you make that donation, by the way. And if it is not already taken, then I might use it. Or you don't have to do anything. My job is to assign you a wrestling nickname that hopefully will live on in infamy. This show is a free listen, of course, so any way that you can support the show is very much appreciated. You can also follow along on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle. You can use the hashtag Solomonster for anything podcast-related. We got a lot to get to here this week. I'm going to be getting into my live TNA thoughts from the Manhattan Center. I was at the final tapings on Friday night, had a blast, so we'll get into that a little bit later. Spoiler Central, just putting you guys on warning, if you don't want any sort of TNA spoilers, you might want to avoid pretty much everything TNA related this week. But that's what happens when you tape so far in advance. It's kind of hard to avoid spoilers, so I would suggest you listen to the TNA portion later. I think it'll be worth your time. Plus, I'm going to be doing a WWE mid-year review at the end of the show, so that should be interesting. Plus, Money in the Bank predictions coming up. A stacked show this week, but first, have some thoughts on the Ring of Honor Best in the World pay-per-view last Sunday. This was Ring of Honor's first foray into traditional pay-per-view. They've done the iPay-per-view thing before, which has been a complete disaster for them. Things went well with the joint ROH New Japan shows last month, so that was encouraging. But before that, Ring of Honor had been the laughingstock of wrestling because they seemingly could not for their lives put on a live eye pay-per-view without having some sort of technical glitch. The feed would go out, people just complaining nonstop, Ring of Honor slow to react to it. But, you know, you had plenty of other indie promotions that were smaller even than Ring of Honor who would do live eye pay-per-view and have no problems. So this was a little bit different in that this was their first quote-unquote real pay-per-view. And I still think that there's a shot this show did better than the TNA Slammiversary show. Well, I guess in due time we'll find out. But I watched this show and I thought overall the presentation and the action and everything else I thought was very, very good. I enjoyed it. You could tell everybody on this show felt like they were busting their ass even more so than usual, like they had something to prove. This was like a big, grand stage to them. And I thought they delivered in pretty much every single match up and down the card. Just some quick thoughts here from stuff that I wanted to talk about that stood out to me. You know, Kevin Steen had a match on the show, of course, with the last real man, Silas Young, who looks like a relic from another era. And Silas Young is an interesting case because when you look at the guy, I don't want to say he doesn't look like much. You know, he looks like an athlete and he's in good shape and all that, but you don't expect some of the flashier stuff from this guy that he does in the ring, and I think he looks a lot wiser, perhaps, than his years based on the look and the mustache and everything else. But Silas Young is very, very good. And Kevin Steen put him over big time at the end of the match. Steen did win, and this was probably Steen's last big feature match in Ring of Honor before going over to WWE. I think it's all but a lock, he's headed over to NXT, probably in August would be my guess. And he came out, he looked dead in the camera and said, "You're looking at the future of professional wrestling," which we may well be. I guess we'll find out how things go for him up north, or down, maybe down south, I should say. They start down south and you work your way up north. That's how it works now. And they had a good match. You know, it wasn't the best match on the card or anything like that, but I think that people in the audience may have thought that this was Kevin Steen's final match, just based on the way they were reacting and everything else. It's not his last match. He does have another month and a half or so with Ring of Honor. I don't know if he'll be at the Brooklyn show at MCU Park in August. That's the old slot that TNA used to have. I'll be at that show. He's not in any of the advertising for the show. That doesn't mean they can't add him to it, but my impression is that he's going to be done with Ring of Honor before then, maybe even the first week of August, so we'll see. But I thought, you know, him and Silas Young had a good match, and then Steen got on the mic afterwards and all but confirmed that he's on his way out, just based on the things he was saying. And Silas Young shook his hand after a while. He had given Silas some props. He left. Steen continued on. And like any good jerk heel, Silas Young ran back out, clipped his knee. And so I don't know if the feud's going to continue for another match at an upcoming show, or if it was just a way for Silas Young to kind of get himself over as a heel. But that's how that went. The match that stood out to me the most was the tag team match between the Briscoes and the team of Matt Hardy and Mike Bennett. Matt Hardy, as a heel in Ring of Honor, is quite good in his role. Maria and Mike Bennett also make for a good combo. Maria, besides being unbelievably hot, Maria, I think, has really hit her stride in her, you know, heel female manager role in Ring of Honor. She's, you know, she could take a bump, and she's just very good at what she does. I think WWE really missed the ball on her. I know she was kind of over for a while as the ditzy interviewer, but they could have done so much more with this woman. And whatever happened, they let her go, and I just think it was a lot of untapped potential there. But the match these two teams had was just crazy. Just killing each other with moves and dives and going through tables. And I have to give props to Matt Hardy because, you know, Matt Hardy signed a deal with TNA at the very least to do the New York City shows. I don't know what his future is, if he's going to do more for TNA or not. But he did sign a deal to come in for TNA and do what he did at the tapings this past week. And there's been a lot of rumor that maybe his time in Ring of Honor is coming to an end. As best as I can tell, the situation with Matt Hardy is that he does not have an actual contract, so I should take that part back. He doesn't actually have a contract, I don't think, with any particular company. He's pretty much a free agent who can come and go as he pleases and make deals with whoever he wants. And if people want him bad enough, then they can have him for the right price. It's not a bad position for him to be in. So his future in Ring of Honor may not be over. It's kind of up in the air right now. I don't know if he's scheduled for any more shows. It certainly didn't come off to me as any sort of blow-off for him, and I'll tell you why. Because Matt Hardy took a crazy bump at the end of this tag team match where, I forgot if it was Mark or Jay, but they suplex Matt from the top of a ridiculously tall ladder down through a table that was set up in the ring. So, you know, it seems kind of like a basic bump, but this was a tall ladder. This was a big bump for Matt Hardy to take, and he took it like a champ. I mean, he took it like a champ, and then immediately after that, they hit a J-driller on him, just drove him down into the mat, pinned him. That would have been a good blow-off for Matt Hardy had he not come back out again later in the show looking none the worse for wear, which I did think was kind of dumb. I would have looked at this and thought, okay, this is a great way to blow this guy off in Ring of Honor if he doesn't come back. But he did actually come back. But I thought that match, for what it was crazy. It was, if you're into that kind of stuff and just an all-out brawl and weapons and mayhem, this match had it all, and Matt took a lot more abuse than I thought he would. Daniels and Kazarian made their Ring of Honor return. Daniels, I think, was in the very first main event of the first Ring of Honor show. I could be wrong about that, but I thought he was. So this was a homecoming for him and Kazarian as well. TNA's loss is ROH's gain. I thought they looked real good here. Daniels especially, you know, and Daniels is 40, I don't know what his name, 43, 44? He's not a young guy, but he moves around in there like he's 25. So Daniels, I thought, in particular, looked really good. They took on the team of Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish, Red Dragon. who are awesome, one of Ring of Honor's best teams, up-and-comers, and Red Dragon got the win here, as they should have, right? The old guard, even though it was their first match back, putting over the new guard. I thought they had a really good match. And what impressed me most, or I should say who impressed me most in this match, besides Daniels, was Kyle O'Reilly. I have not seen a lot of his work recently. Again, I don't get to watch Ring of Honor week to week. I'll go to the shows every now and then and kind of pay attention to what's going on. But I admit, I have not seen a whole lot of Kyle O'Reilly's work. I did see him at the ROH New Japan show last month. I think they were in there against the Young Bucks. I saw him here. He stood out to me. I think he's got a real future, even as a singles guy at some point. He's doing the tag team thing right now, but he impressed me. The other guy who impressed me on the show was Adam Cole in the main event. And I saw a lot of interviews that Adam Cole did in the lead-up to this show. He did some promotion for it. He was on with Sam Roberts, which you could probably find on YouTube. You know, very poised, very articulate. He's the kind of guy who would fit right in a WWE. And he's another guy who WWE passed on. You know, for all the talent that WWE has brought in and is bringing in, again, Steen's probably on his way there, Kent is on his way in, Prince Devitt's probably going over there. For all the great guys they're bringing in, they've missed out on a ton of talent. And I don't really understand why a guy like an Adam Cole would go to a tryout camp for WWE, as he did many months ago, and not get a call back. You know, he is kind of on the small side, and WWE, maybe they've reached their quota of small guys. I just think that's really short-sighted if that's the case, because Adam Cole, he carries himself like a star. I thought he kind of grew into that role as the Ring of Honor champion in the months that he had the belt, and he turned into a great heel. And the match with him and Elgin, I thought, was very good. One of the highlights of the match came towards the finish when the entire building thought the match was over. Elgin hit his move, and people started throwing streamers into the ring, and it was a near fall. The match was not over. And when the people realized that they had messed up, and in fact the match was still going on, they started chanting, "We fucked up," which I was kind of amused by. And then eventually Elgin did hit his finish again. He got the pin. So Michael Elgin is the new Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Champion. I believe only the 20th ROH champion in a 12-year time span, which when you compare that to TNA or WWE, is actually very impressive that we have not had more people holding the belt in that time. So good for him. You know, Elgin, I think he deserves it in that he's worked his ass off. He is a guy who I think can go in there and have good matches with almost anybody. There is a certain thing he's lacking. I think there's a certain charisma he's lacking. I can't say that Michael Elgin is an exciting guy to me. But he's, you know, he's a big, thick guy. He goes in there. He beats people up. He's very strong. I know we see Cesaro now on WWE television doing that kind of delayed suplex where he'll pick a guy up who's out on the apron and suplex him into the ring and not suplex him from the ropes, which is a great feat of strength. The first person I saw do that, though, wasn't Cesaro. It was Michael Elgin at a Ring of Honor show against Jay Lethal, I think, last year. So he's a strong guy. I think he'll do fine as the champion. And, yeah, I was just, overall, I was impressed by the entire show. And like I said, Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly in particular stood out to me. I think those guys have a big future wherever they end up. Hopefully WWE at some point will come to their senses and give these guys a shot. I thought it was a strong first effort for Ring of Honor, and hopefully the pay-per-view does well enough where they can come back again at the end of the year, their final battle show, and have a second pay-per-view. I think that's what they're waiting for. They're waiting to find out how well this show did, and that will dictate whether or not we see another Ring of Honor pay-per-view. Shift over to WWE. Tonight is the Money in the Bank pay-per-view from Boston, and I'm going to give fair warning here. Again, if you are somebody who likes to avoid spoilers, and you avoided the big spoiler, possible spoiler that leaked this week in terms of the main event, and you don't want to know anything about that, skip ahead, because I am going to mention it. So I'm just giving you fair warning, but let's go through the card here. We'll start. I'm already talking with my Boston accent. We'll start from the top and work our way down. Main event is a Money in the Bank ladder match for the vacant WWE World Heavyweight Championship. John Cena, Roman Reigns, Sheamus, Kane, Bray Wyatt, Randy Orton, Cesaro, and Alberto Del Rio, who is just ridiculously out of place in this match. The off chance that Daniel Bryan is healthy enough to come back next month, I would say maybe Kane wins this match here, then Bryan beats him for the belt next month at Battleground. and goes on to wrestle Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, which I believe was the original plan here, and a match that I would still like to see. You know, there's people out there, oh, I can't see a Bryan versus Brock match. It just, he would be ridiculously overmatched, and it's just, I shake my head whenever I hear that. You know, as though we've never seen a big man against a smaller man in wrestling before. What a concept, I know. What a concept. But the off chance that he is healthy enough and that does happen, that's the only way I could possibly see Kane winning this match. Otherwise, I don't think Kane stands any chance of winning this match. But I'm sticking with John Cena as my pick. I said before I had pitched the idea for a Cena-Lesnar match even before this little spoiler deal leaked. Yeah, the cover art for SummerSlam's 2014 Blu-ray was leaked early on Amazon, and it just so happens to feature John Cena and Brock Lesnar on it. And WWE had it pulled off there, but the poster's everywhere now. I mean, it's already out there. The genie is out of the bottle. You can't put it back in. They even included it in their own email blast that they sent out to members on their mailing list on Friday, mentioning John Cena and Brock Lesnar again at SummerSlam. So, would not shock me if they swerved everybody at the show tonight who now thinks that John Cena is going to win. But you know what? Even if they do, and I'm sticking with Cena. Cena is my pick to win this match. But you know what? Even if they do swerve everybody by having somebody like a Roman Reigns or a Bray Wyatt win the match, I still say it's Cena versus Lesnar at SummerSlam. I think that's the plan now. I think that's set in stone. That match is happening no matter what. Maybe it's not for the belt. Maybe it's just another big match on the card and the championship is contested in a different match. But to me, it wouldn't make any sense because, you know, Brock conquered the streak. And if you go back before that, before The Undertaker came forward and said, listen, you know, I'm going to wrestle you at WrestleMania, Brock was out there with Paul Heyman on TV crowing about wanting the WWE Championship. He kind of forgot about it with The Undertaker feud, and then he hasn't been back since. So the next time we see Brock Lesnar, it would make sense for him to want to go after the championship because there's nothing else for him to do. You know, we know Brock's going to be back soon. He's going to be there at SummerSlam. I believe he's supposed to be there for Night of Champions as well. He's coming back for two pay-per-views. What else is there for him to do if not go after the title? Nothing else would really make sense. You know, now that he's beaten the streak, he's on this level now where, you know, just to stick him with somebody for the sake of sticking him in there with somebody doesn't really make any sense. I assume the turn maybe with Cesaro will come at some point, although I think it's too early for that. Going after the title is really the only thing that would make sense for Brock Lesnar to come back to at this point. So I think he is going to be in the championship match at SummerSlam, and that will be with John Cena. You know, that's my pick. I'm sticking with it. I think it's a big-time match they could do. Only if they get the belt off Cena and put it on Brock. Otherwise, I have no interest at all in seeing John Cena win this match. And to be honest with you, even though I want to see Cena-Lesnar, that is a match I would like to see again. I'm not enamored with the idea of John Cena winning again on pay-per-view in the main event, with John Cena becoming a 15-time world champion or whatever the hell it is now. It's not like I like that. I would love to get some new blood in there. It's just not the right time for it. If the plan is to put Brock in there with somebody for the belt at SummerSlam and probably put the belt on Brock, I don't want to see Roman Reigns get a 2-month footnote of a title reign. I don't want to see Bray Wyatt get a 2-month footnote of a title reign. Nor do I see heel versus heel, so I don't even think that's possible. You know, and I sure as hell don't need to see Brock and Del Rio. I don't need to see Brock and Kane. Brock and Sheamus even is a match that, once upon a time, when Brock first came back, I thought that might be a cool match between two guys just kind of beating the hell out of each other. But Sheamus, to me, is just, he's a great wrestler. He goes in there and has great matches with guys. But he does nothing for me. I'm not excited at all at the idea of a Brock Lesnar-Sheamus match. So there's very few opponents that you could put in there right now with Brock Lesnar that would excite me. Cena-Brock would still be a big-time match. Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar could be a big-time match. Not at SummerSlam. Maybe WrestleMania next year. That could be your main event right there. But it's too early to do it now. So when you look at the, you know, you take a look at the field of choices here, I don't want to see John Cena go over yet again in another pay-per-view main event, but it's the outcome that makes sense. Because otherwise, I think you're shortchanging these other guys. I don't need to see another guy screwed out of a championship. We already saw that with Daniel Bryan. Month after month after month, he would win the belt. He would be stripped of the belt. He would get the belt back. He would be screwed out of it. How many times can you do the angle where the babyface gets screwed out of the championship? You can't keep going back to that. So, Cena's my pick here. Money in the Bank ladder match for the contract will feature Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, Kofi Kingston, Jack Swagger, Dolph Ziggler, Rob Van Dam, and possibly Bad News Barrett. I didn't read one way or the other whether he's in the match or not. Maybe they have something up on WWE.com. I'm assuming he's out, because even if the injury is not as serious as it appeared, if he's going to be out a few weeks, I doubt they would have him in that match with a separated shoulder. Jack Swagger injured Barrett at the SmackDown tapings on Tuesday, threw him into the ringside barricade, and Barrett was instantly injured. And people who saw it knew right away he was very upset. He was cursing. He was banging on the floor. Kind of what happened when he got hurt that time when I think it was Big Show in a battle royal on Raw threw Dolph Ziggler out of the ring, and Dolph landed right on Barrett's arm. Barrett had just been eliminated before that. And that's when Barrett suffered that really nasty elbow injury that kept him out for months and months and months. And the weird irony here is that when that first injury happened, I believe the plan had been for Wade Barrett to go on to win the Money in the Bank match, which would have been on pay-per-view, not at WrestleMania, but there had been a lot of talk at that time of Barrett going on to win Money in the Bank, and that never happened because he wasn't able to make it back in time. And it kind of derailed whatever push they may have had for him. And here we are again in a situation where Wade Barrett may have been cost his chance to win the Money in the Bank contract due to injury. So it's a tough break for the guy. You know, I feel bad for him, but he's been swaggered. So I doubt he'll be there, or maybe he'll be there, but he won't do much. I certainly don't see him winning the match now, if that was even the plan to begin with. Seth Rollins is my pick. I think he'll end up with the contract. Usos defend the tag team titles against the Wyatt family. I'm going to go with the Usos to retain the belts. Be bold here. Divas champion Paige defending against Naomi. Figure Cameron gets involved here, costs her partner the match either on purpose or by accident, and that helps Paige retain the title. Rusev, one-on-one with Big E. I figure the Rusev push continues, so he's my pick. Rybacksel taking on Goldust and Stardust. Goldie and Stardust are my pick. And Layla against Summer Rae, with Fandango as the guest referee. I figure this will end up being some kind of no contest. You know, maybe they both end up attacking Fandango or something like that. I just don't see one really, you know, being that much stronger than the other. I mean, if it were up to me, I'd have Summer Rae go over. I think Summer Rae is your next star of the division. I wish they would do more with her. But probably have some kind of fuck finish in this match, I would guess. Daniel Bryan is going to be on the pre-show. I don't know if that's live or taped. I think he'll be there live, but maybe not. And supposedly he's going to be answering questions from the universe. That's what they say. Questions from the universe. What galaxy or planets? I don't know. But that's what they said. So Daniel Bryan will be there, and you know what? It's a weird deal, because if this were anybody else, because Bryan's been out now for a few weeks. You know, we saw him on TV, it was many weeks ago. It's not like he's been gone for months, but we haven't seen him in a while. They took the titles away from him. There is a certain element of interest, I think, in hearing from Bryan for the first time, how he feels about being stripped of the belts and all that kind of stuff. And they're promoting his first appearance back for the pre-show. If it were anybody else, do you really think, if this were John Cena or somebody like that, that his big return interview or whatever would be promoted for the frickin' pre-show? I mean, if that doesn't tell you right there what they think about this guy, I don't know about Bryan's future again as the world champion. I just, again, unless he's coming back early, and they know it, and they're withholding that information, and Kane's going to get the belt, and Bryan's going to beat him for it, and everything's going to be right according to plan heading into SummerSlam, I don't see that happening. Whenever Bryan is able to make it back, and who even knows if it'll be before SummerSlam? We don't know. It could be another 2-3 months before he comes back. I am not optimistic about him getting back in that title picture. I really do wonder if his time has come and gone. And you know what? If his time is come and gone, and they're going to move on to, you know, whether it's Lesnar or Roman Reigns or somebody like that, if they get some fresh blood in there and they have an idea for where they're going and they have a strong program, that's fine. I have no problem with that. It's a shame things came to an end the way they did. I thought the guy deserved at least a nice little run with the belt before they took it away from him. And then the injury happened. And I just don't see them putting Daniel Bryan right back in the title picture. I just don't see it. So I really do think that his time in that headline position has probably come to an end. And at least he has the memory of winning the championship in the main event of WrestleMania 30. They can't take that away from him. It's just a shame how it ended up for the guy. But the pre-show is going to be hosted by Renee Young. Josh Matthews got shit canned this week, part of the budget cuts. They let him go. He had been with the company since 2002 after popping up on that very first season of Tough Enough and losing. And they turned him into an announcer, and he had been with the company ever since. So it was kind of surprising. I could think of other people I would have probably cut bait on before Josh Matthews. I thought he did a good job. He was the one who anchored all the pre-shows and the post-shows. He had done some play-by-play on SmackDown at one point. Didn't last very long. So kind of a shame, I guess, to see him go. And yet we still have Jerry Lawler on commentary every single week that we get to enjoy. Raw this past Monday night was live from Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. And the big angle on this show actually had nothing to do with Money in the Bank and had everything to do with the exit of Vicky Guerrero from WWE after a 9-year career in the company. Vicky is officially gone. She has moved on to a career, I believe, in medical administration. She's moving on with her life. She's leaving wrestling behind. Of course, never say never. I'm sure we'll see Vicky pop up at least doing cameos at some point in the future. Hell, I could see them giving her a Hall of Fame induction at some point. I would not put it past them. But SEScoops.com was the first website, actually, to break the news about Vicky leaving WWE. This was right after WrestleMania, in fact, was when she was supposed to leave. And, in fact, Webmaster Mike broke that story right here on The Sound Off. It was episode 322 when we did our special post-Mania wrap-up show in New Orleans, and he broke the news on there. What happened is WWE asked her to stay a little bit longer. They wanted time to come up with a proper storyline exit for her. She agreed to stay a little bit longer, which has happened before. There are people who have given their notice and said, I'm out of here, and WWE talks them into staying. Jeff Hardy being a classic example of that back in 2009. Jeff was on his way out. He was burnt out. He was done. He was going to at least just take some time off. And they kept talking him into staying and talking him into staying, and he stayed. And he put over CM Punk in that last feud. He put Punk over, actually, in SummerSlam in a TLC match. He put him over in a cage match on SmackDown. Left the company, and then, of course, he got arrested. But so that was the case with Vicky. She stayed a little bit longer. They came up with this idea for her, which is what we saw last Monday, although it was Vicky's idea, from what I read, to pay tribute to her late husband, Eddie. So all of the Eddie Guerrero references and the music and everything else, that was Vicky's idea, because it was Eddie. I mean, Eddie, obviously, were it not for her marriage with Eddie, she would have had nothing to do with the wrestling business. And when he died, they gave her a job, and it just kind of went from there. And she ended up in a whole variety of different roles throughout her career, babyface, mostly as a heel. She owes that all to Eddie. And she wanted to pay tribute to his memory, because without him, she would not have had a career in WWE in the first place. So I actually thought that was kind of cool that she would recognize that and push for it, and they let her do it. And the fans were chanting Eddie, and she talked about the Guerrero name and how it's the only name in wrestling more respected than McMahon. She came out using Eddie's Los Guerreros music. She was using Eddie's catchphrase about lying, cheating, and stealing. And by the way, how great was it to hear that music again? The Los Guerreros theme on Raw. I was kind of sad that the crowd didn't react more to it, but I have to keep reminding myself, you know, Eddie's been dead now for almost 10 years, which is a scary thought that it's been that long. So I'm sure there were people who had no idea that it was Eddie Guerrero's theme song when they started playing it, and they probably thought it was some new wrestler coming out to make his debut or something. But just to recap the whole chain of events here, what happened is, you may recall the projectile vomiting nonsense from Raw the week before, which was truly a low point in the show's history. And Stephanie came out and was ready to fire Vicky, and Vicky told her, wait, there's got to be another way. And Stephanie said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll put you in a match. If you win your match, you get to keep your job. And of course, that match turned out to be against Stephanie herself, and just the way Stephanie carried herself in that whole opening promo, you know, I got to give her props. She is probably the best heel in that company right now. She is one of the best heels in all of wrestling. And she doesn't even wrestle. Single-handedly turned Vicky Guerrero babyface in that opening segment. It's not an easy thing to do. I mean, you can play off, I guess, the memory of Eddie That kind of helps. But Vicky went from being this hated heel figure to being this beloved babyface that they actually were getting behind, and they wanted to see her keep her job. After singing the na-na song at her before and wanting her to be gone, all of a sudden these people were hoping and praying and rooting for Vicky to keep her job. And a lot of that had to do with how awesome of a job Stephanie did in her opening promo and just all around carrying herself like a bitch. She really is her father's daughter. And when you watch her and you listen to her and her mannerisms and everything else, she's like a female clone of Vince McMahon, only with a vagina. I mean, that's really the only difference between the two of them. That, I guess, in the dimple in the chin, but it's scary. It's scary how much alike they are. And so anyway, I thought that was done really, really well. And then even later on, when they came out, there was a tub full of some kind of gravy. It's like it looked like the things they would use in the old gravy bowl matches during the Attitude Era. And Stephanie had a couple of heel divas come out. They were going to shove Vicky in the pool and embarrass her on her way out. And Vicky outsmarted them, and each time the heel came over to throw her in there, she kind of sidestepped them, and they went in there. Layla fell in there. I think Rosa Mendez may have been there, and Alicia Fox, I think, was the other one. Then Stephanie gave the most comical knee lift you've ever seen in your life. Seriously, go back and watch it. She attempted to give Vicky a knee lift and knock her into the pool. Didn't quite work out that way, so she ended up just kind of shoving her in there. And Vicky took her bump, and she was just covered in this gunk, whatever the hell it was. And Stephanie was awesome here. She started celebrating and doing a yes chant, and she started singing the na-na song. And then at that point, Vicky realized, well, I lost, which means I lost my job and I'm fired. And she's standing between the pool, and Stephanie is right in the middle. And Stephanie realizes, oh, shit. And she tries to talk her way out of it. She says, well, keep in mind, let's keep your retirement in mind here. And Vicky would have none of it. She threw Stephanie in there. And to her credit, Stephanie went all out here. She took the bump in there, and she kept slipping and sliding. And she was covered in mud and dirt and goo and whatever the hell that stuff was, chocolate. She got one over on Stephanie. Vicky was covered in this crap, but she still got to go out gracefully and did the little shimmy dance that Eddie used to do. And people cheered her, and it was actually a really cool moment, and was handled infinitely better than I ever would have expected it to be. And, you know, you take a look back at the career of Vicky Guerrero. Like I said, she spent 9 years overall in that company. And remember how she first became involved in this whole thing. It was the Eddie Guerrero-Rey Mysterio feud from 2005, when they were feuding over the custody of Dominic, right, Rey's kid. And Eddie was like, you know, he's actually my son. I mean, it was a stupid concept. But, you know, we got a feud between Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio, so it's hard to argue there. And they had that custody match at SummerSlam. It was a ladder match. And I still remember Vicky was part of the whole storyline. And she was out there. She came out for the match. She was involved in the finish. I think Rey won the match. But I think Vicky was late, maybe at one point she was supposed to interfere or climb up the ladder, and Vicky was nowhere to be found, or she was out of position, or whatever the problem was. I haven't seen the match in so long. I just remember Eddie was just cussing up a storm. He was pissed off looking for Vicky. Where the fuck is Vicky? And it was quite the scene in that match. And from that to, of course, Eddie passed away. Vicky stuck around. They made her the general manager of SmackDown. She was just a heat magnet as a heel. One of the biggest heels the company ever had, just in terms of the reaction that she would elicit from an audience. I couldn't believe the kind of nuclear heat this woman would get just by walking out on stage. When she was at her peak as the heel GM over on SmackDown, and she would just walk, her mere presence elicited boos like you've never heard from a crowd before. And then as soon as she would open her mouth, it would only get louder. And it was hard to understand sometimes because it was so damn loud in the buildings. I mean, you would have wrestlers on that roster, heels, who would kill to have the kind of heat that came naturally for this woman. She was so naturally hateable in that role. That's what I'll probably remember most about her. And the stuff with Edge on SmackDown, the Vicky Edge stuff and the wedding that never was. The failed pairing with Eric Escobar. Remember him? He was on TV for all of 3 or 4 months before they got rid of him. The pairing with Dolph Ziggler, which you could say helped out Dolph. I thought that went on for too long. it got to the point where it was like, all right, split them up already. It's like, enough already. Now, it got to the point where it was doing, I thought, more harm than good for Dolph. But at first, it was something for Dolph, you know? I mean, Vicky was a heat magnet, and she was able to transfer some of that heat over to Dolph at a time when he wasn't over as much as he is now, which is kind of funny because he's not pushes anything now, but yet he's still over somehow. All the times they embarrassed and made fun of her for being fat, for being ugly, you know, even after she lost a whole bunch of weight, because Vicky did, she slimmed down a lot. If you look at her from the beginning and you look at her years later, she lost a lot of weight. You know, I always found that to be disgusting, personally. I know it's all entertainment, but, you know, some of the stuff they do, it goes a little far beyond that. You know, you could just hear the idiots in the back laughing, you know, yucking it up. And it just would make me so angry. I mean, stuff like that, the Piggy James stuff that they did with Mickey James, or, you know, Molly Holly has a big fat ass, or Vince McMahon mocking Jim Ross's Bell's palsy, you know, his Bell's palsy face on that one Raw when he was wearing the cowboy hat, and making fun of him before his colon surgery, or any of the other times they've hidden behind the excuse of, oh, it's sports entertainment, when in reality, they were just being a bunch of juvenile dicks and mean-spirited for no good reason. I never liked any of that stuff, but to their credit, they gave Vicky about as good of a send-off as they've given anybody who has chosen to leave the company voluntarily, the way that she did. It's like, when you're in their world, when you're in WWE, it's like the mob. You're in for life. And this notion that somebody would choose on their own to leave and then pursue something else, I'm sure is just something that blows Vince McMahon's mind. And that's what Vicky did. You know, I'm sure she had a nice little cushy position with the company and was probably making decent money and didn't have to do much. I mean, it was a lot of traveling. Maybe she didn't want to do that anymore. But I commend her. I have a lot of respect for her for choosing to go out the way that she did and pursuing other interests, because you don't see a lot of people doing that. I think there's probably a lot of guys who maybe would like to do that in WWE who don't have the means, or who don't have the courage to say, you know what? I don't enjoy it here anymore. I'm going to leave and go somewhere else. It's a hard thing to do because everyone aspires to be in WWE, right? If you get into wrestling, you want to be in WWE. There is no such thing as getting into wrestling because you want to perform in front of 50 people every week. If you are a serious wrestler and you get into wrestling, I mean, you have weekend warriors who have other jobs who just want to have a little bit of fun on the weekends. I'm not talking about people like that. I know people like that, and that's fine. But if you get into wrestling to have any sort of real success, you want to be on the big stage, and the big stage is WWE. Well, with Vicky, she never aspired to be a wrestler, so she never had that problem. She kind of fell into wrestling because it was the family business. She married into it. She gave them notice and said she was leaving, and they asked her to stay a little bit longer. She was a total team player, and in a way, they rewarded her for that. Think about the way somebody like Lita exited the company many years ago. I know she's in the Hall of Fame now, but she didn't have a Hall of Fame exit with Crime Time having a wholesale and selling her panties to people in the crowd. Why? Because she hooked up with Edge behind Matt Hardy's back? Isn't that more or less what happened with Stephanie? That led to the breakup of Triple H in China? You think they'd give her the same kind of exit they gave Lita? Of course not. Stephanie got her comeuppance, Vicky got the last laugh and a big reaction, and that was really cool. And the best part about this whole thing now is with Vicky gone, we officially have no general manager for either Raw or SmackDown. Finally, the most useless position in WWE is now over with, at least for the time being. Let me enjoy this while it lasts. Harper and Rowan now have their own theme music, a harmonica version of He's Got the Whole World in His Hands. It's so creepy, I hate it, and that's exactly why it works so well for these two guys. I hate it so much that I love it. Too many damn heels with catchy theme music that people like to sing along to. You didn't see people singing along to Jake the Snake Roberts' old theme song when he was a heel. You know why? Because it had no words, other than trust me at the beginning. That was it. We need more of that. Luke Harper also beat Jimmy Uso in a singles match 1 week after I complained on this podcast about how Harper never gets any singles wins, so that made me happy. Of course, they immediately came back with a Rowan versus Jey Uso match that Jey won because, well, even Steven booking. Wyatt's beat up the champs after the match, posed with the titles. Naomi pinned Alicia Fox in 4 minutes 58 seconds of a Divas match that you would never even know was going on because the announcers and the production truck paid almost no attention to it. Instead, they focused on the announcers, okay, who had Cameron and Paige with them on commentary. They were bickering back and forth. You know, it's fine to cut back to the desk every now and then during the match to show, you know, the two women, let's say, staring at each other from across the table and kind of build up tension or whatever. But to keep the camera on the announce desk for 30 seconds straight, which they did at one point, 30 seconds straight, they kept the camera on the announce desk. And in the background, the whole time, you can hear bodies hitting the mat. We couldn't see a freaking thing. My ears work fine, you know? I could hear them bitching on headset. I don't need to see them sitting there sniping at each other. Show the fucking match. Best moment was when the match ended and Paige stood up. Jerry Lawler was caught on camera blatantly staring at Paige's ass. Not that I blame him, but she's far too old for Lawler. By the way, Lawler actually tweeted out a screen cap of himself staring at this girl's ass, which Paige herself then retweeted. I thought that was funny. Backstage, Sheamus and Roman Reigns were getting ready for their match. They were teaming with John Cena against Randy Orton, Bray Wyatt, Cesaro, and Del Rio in a rematch from the main event of SmackDown the week before. We also got Ziggler and Barrett later in the show, which was also a rematch from SmackDown. And so, for those of you wondering why I rarely watch SmackDown, all I need to do is watch Raw 3 days later to get the same matches. Why waste my time watching the same thing twice? Reigns also told Sheamus here, "I believe in Roman Reigns, and so should you," before walking off. This should absolutely be his campaign slogan when he runs for office. Bo Dallas beat Titus O'Neil out of nowhere with the Bo Dog. Bo told everybody he was now 9-0 when the match was over and went to offer Titus some words of encouragement, but Titus smacked the microphone out of his hands and it fell to the floor. Bo was so determined to help this man that he went out onto the floor to retrieve the microphone. And when he did that, I lost it. That was so great. He blamed his butterfingers for the microphone slipping out of his hands, and he told Titus to get back on his horse. He's just trying to encourage the guy. There's nothing wrong with that. He's a positive fellow. That's what I like about Bo Dallas. Triple H was out to announce the competitors in the Money in the Bank contract match at the pay-per-view. Then he introduced Seth Rollins as his favorite to win. RVD came out on stage and didn't think that Triple H or Rollins was taking him very seriously. Seth said that he would take Rob more seriously if it were 2005. And Van Damme reacted by saying that in 2005, Seth was busy bugging his parents to let him stay up late and watch RVD on TV. Van Damme then reminded Triple H about the time he crushed his throat in the first Elimination Chamber match. "Good times," he said. He says that now. It wasn't good times for RVD the month after that when he was at the WWF restaurant in Times Square scarfing down cheeseburgers during the pay-per-view instead of actually wrestling. Anyway, Triple H signed RVD versus Rollins. They had a good match that ended with Dean Ambrose running in and attacking Rollins for the DQ after he curb-stomped Van Damme. And Van Damme sold this. This is the best-selling of a curb-stomp you'll ever see. And anyway, Ambrose went nuts on Rollins. Rollins got away. Dean got on the mic. He threatened that if he was not added to the Money in the Bank match, he would still show up at the pay-per-view and he would wreck the damn show. And he got his wish after Rollins went to Triple H and begged him to add Ambrose to the match so that way he could at least keep an eye on him. I like how they at least had Rollins try to apply logic to why he would want this man in the Money in the Bank match. So I did appreciate that. Dolph Ziggler and Wade Barrett had a Intercontinental title match on this show that was just outstanding. It was a long match, too. They gave these guys a lot of time. They had the big-time pre-match intros that they usually only save for the World Championship matches. They did it a few times when Big E had the Intercontinental belt, but then he never defended it, so we never got to see these big-time intros. So it made the match feel special. Crowd got into it because Barrett's over. Ziggler is still over. God only knows why. The people were way, way into it, especially the final few minutes. They were going nuts. This is awesome chance. Great crowd heat. And just a great representation of what the Intercontinental title should mean. I'm not going to let it fool me. It's not as though that they've removed their head from their ass and all of a sudden they've realized the value of the Intercontinental title. It's going to go right back to where it was. And if Barrett is hurt, I have no idea what they're going to do with the belt, if they're just going to let him hold it. I feel like we've seen so many battle royals and tournaments recently that I'm kind of in tournament fatigue at this point. So I don't know what they do if he's going to be gone for a few months. But for one night, this was what the Intercontinental title should be all about. Two guys in there, busting their ass, having a great match, People going crazy for it. The finish was great, too, because what happened is Ziggler came flying into the corner, and in midair, Barrett just pasted him with the bullhammer elbow, just killed him. And I think a piece of gum went flying out of his mouth, and Lawler was like, oh, I think it was a tooth, and he pinned him, and, you know, it was what it was. I didn't really expect Ziggler to win. I'm smarter than that. But this was great. I loved everything about this, and I'd love to see more of it. Like I said, hopefully Barrett is not hurt too badly. We had Jack Swagger and Kofi Kingston, on the other hand. They had a match right after this, and this match sucked. This was a terrible match. Not the best night for either guy. Very sloppy. Some botched moves during the match. I mean, first this, then Swagger injures Barrett the night after. I don't know what's going on with Swagger. Although Kofi also kind of fucked some stuff up in this match, but this was no good. Damian Sandow was out there dressed up as Abe Lincoln. He wrestled Big E in a tuxedo. He's one step away from those suicide skits they did years ago with Tim White. That's the path that Sandow is going down at this point. Big E won. Then he did a Preacher Man promo in that he sounded exactly like a preacher or pastor or whatever the proper term is. He sounded like Don King, basically. And I guess, you know, hey, dude's got to try to stand out somehow. They're not doing anything else with him. Rusev attacked Big E from behind and put him in the accolades. That sets up their match tonight at Money in the Bank. Main event had Cena, Reigns, Sheamus beating Orton, Cesaro, Wyatt, and Del Rio when Sheamus beat Cesaro with the brogue kick. Match really picked up in the last 2 minutes or so. Everybody was hitting their finish one after the other. Then out came the Demon Kane. That's his name now, by the way, the Demon Kane. He laid waste to everybody, and Triple H came out to tell us that Kane had been added to the Money in the Bank match for the championship. Roman Reigns then came out of nowhere, speared Kane down, stood tall to end the show. I like that. I, you figure Kane's going to be the last man standing here to end the go-home show, but no. Roman Reigns is the last man standing here to end this go-home edition of Raw. So I like that aspect of it. At least it was him and not the Demon Kane. So that was Raw. As a go-home show, wasn't very good. But as a show, I liked the key stuff. I thought the Intercontinental title match was well worth going out of your way to watch. A lot of you guys don't even watch Raw anymore. You listen to this podcast. If you could find it, go watch that match. I think you'll enjoy it. The Vicky stuff I thought was well done. A hell of a lot more respectful than I thought it was going to be going into it. I was pleasantly surprised with the exit that they gave her. So I would give it a thumbs up. One more quick note here before we move on. Tokyo Sports Japan reported this weekend that WWE is going to make the official announcement that Kenta, the big star from Pro Wrestling Noah, has signed with the promotion. They're going to make the announcement during their tour of Japan next month. They're going to have a press conference, I believe, on July 12th. It's the date that I scribbled down here. So it'll be interesting to see if they call him Kenta or if they use a different name. It's his real name, and they're doing this in Japan. Everybody there knows him as Kenta. It would be kind of silly to give him some different name. So we'll see. You know, when they did the press conference for Sin Cara down in Mexico, and oddly enough, they sent Jim Ross, of all people, down there for that one. They announced that his name would be Sin Cara, but, you know, it wasn't like Mystico was his real name. Yeah, WWE has not had a lot of luck with guys who get press conference treatment in the past. Taka Michinoku got a press conference many years ago. I remember Vince McMahon, and I think it was Vince McMahon in, was it Tom Pritchard? Not Tom Pritchard, Bruce Pritchard, maybe? I just remember there seeing a photo of Taka signing his ceremonial contract. They made a big deal about his signing when they got him, and he had some success. You know, he was the light heavyweight champion for a while, but then after a while, of course, it just fizzled out, and he became a laughingstock. I think Tiger Ali Singh may have had a press conference when they signed him, and he was a bust. Sin Cara, I mean, we all know how that ended up. So hopefully Kenta has more luck than those guys did, but that's a big pickup for them. Kenta is damn good. Would not shock me if Daniel Bryan went to bat for him either, because I know Bryan has made the comment before that Kenta, if he isn't his most famous opponent or his most his favorite, I should say, opponent, he's one of his favorites. They had a ton of kick-ass matches back when Bryan was still in Ring of Honor. I saw some of them. Kenta's great, but we've seen a lot of guys who are great who go to WWE, and they kind of strip them down. They don't let them really do everything that they can do. Adrian Neville is a good example of that. Adrian Neville is great, but imagine Adrian Neville times five if they actually let the guy go out there and do what he does best. But that's not how they want things done. You've got to slow it down. You've got to do it the WWE way. And you can't ignore the 800-pound elephant in the room, which is WWE's treatment of Asian talent in the past. You know, when they bring in guys from Japan or wherever of Asian descent, they don't handle them well. It's like they don't know how to use them. And I can give rattle off example after example after example. Yoshitatsu's a guy they just let go, and he could have been a solid mid-card guy for them, and they did nothing with him. They did jack shit with Yoshitatsu. You know, they bring in a bunch of Asian stars, and it's like they put them in that stereotypical mold where they talk broken English and they play it for comedy, and they, you know, they did that with Funaki. You'll have guys who can fit the comedy role. Kenta is not a guy who you play for comedy, so I hope they know what they're doing. I hope when they bring him in, they give him a real shot, they don't pigeonhole him and stick him with some stereotypical bullshit gimmick. Because if they do that, then I don't know what the point of even bringing the guy into the company is. So I hope they have some sense of what they're going to do with him, and they don't treat him like a joke. And if they don't treat him like a joke, then it's a huge pickup for them. It's a big, big signing for WWE. If you've never seen the guy work before, look up some of his work. He's really good. He's small, but he's really good. And hopefully they do the right thing with him. NXT this week opened with the Vaudevillains, Aiden English announcing himself and Simon Gotch at a total combined height of over 12 feet tall. That's different. We usually don't hear about the total combined height of a team when they come out. They beat T. Perkins and Matt Sugarman in a short match. Sugarman is no Philip Gouljar, but still a pretty cool name. They won with their finish, which they're now calling That's a Wrap. Gotch does the Lambeau plunge that Mr. Anderson does. I guess Sheamus does that too. And then English follows up from the second rope on the inside with a Swanton bomb for the pin. Xavier Woods made his entrance, which automatically meant he was losing. There was a little commotion at ringside before the match with Woods and CJ Parker, who was walking around again with his sign. One side read, "Stop the Big Thaw." The other side read, "Every day is Earth Day." I wish the earth would open up and swallow him whole. Then out came Bull Dempsey, billed from the mean streets of Brooklyn, New York, so I became an instant fan. Hey, you know, depending on the part of Brooklyn that you're in, I can attest there are some mean streets around here. Unlike those mean streets of Greenwich that Shane McMahon and the Mean Street Posse claim to be from. Dempsey calls himself the last of a dying breed, models himself after Bruiser Brody, although he gave me more of a Taz vibe from the old ECW days. Taz was in better cosmetic shape than Bull Dempsey is. Bull's kind of a pudgy guy, truth be told. He looks like any random WWF jobber that would get killed by the Steiner brothers on an episode of Superstars back in 1993. But I like that. Yeah, I like that he's different than a lot of the guys down there. That's what I liked about Bray Wyatt, too, when he first came up and started getting over. He didn't look like everybody else. He didn't look cookie cutter. You know, Bull Dempsey's got six-pack abs just like I do. They just so happen to be protected by a layer of fat. But they're in there. They're in there somewhere. Crowd was into him. They chanted, "Bull, Bull, Bull." Well, let me temper that. Crowd was into him when he first came out. They were chanting his first name. Once the match got started, the crowd died. Because the match was boring. As much as I do like, I like the guy. It's a good first start, and for all the reasons I just mentioned, he's different. But the match died a death because people just weren't into it. And, you know, 85% of the match was Bull Dempsey giving the guy a chin lock, you know, or a headlock. It was some kind of lock. And he didn't really do much. But, again, the crowd did chant Bull, Bull, Bull there at the beginning. They also told him to put some pants on at one point. His singlet did not leave much to the imagination. He won with a move he calls the Bulldozer, which at first glance looked like a brainbuster, but then they showed the replay of it. It's a freaking body slam. Seriously, a body slam is his finishing hold. That's some bull right there. Dude needs a new move. The only other knock I have is that he worked rest holds, which I already mentioned, and he's got to work on that too. I mean, rest holds are fine. A heel puts the baby face in like a rest hold for, you know, a few seconds. But to have 85% of the match dominated by rest holds is just unacceptable. It serves no purpose. It serves no purpose. It's not exciting. It's boring. It's lazy. And I don't want to see that again. Seriously, just headlock into chinlock, chinlock into another chinlock. I felt like I was watching a Randy Orton match. Another man who never wears any pants. Next up was the debut of Becky Lynch, the former Rebecca Knox. She is Irish, and so, of course, they have her dancing a jig down to the ring. Then she dances some more inside the ring, if you can call that dancing. I'm not quite sure what the hell that was, but it was pretty damn annoying, I know that much. But she's a good wrestler, so that's the most important thing. She had a good showing here with Summer Rae, not without its flaws. Wasn't a perfect match, but I thought she did fine. They're furthering the breakup of the BFFs, more dissension with Summer, arguing with Sasha and Charlotte at ringside. They were outside. Becky went for the distraction roll-up, and I was about to flip my shit. But then Summer kicked out at two, and I calmed down. Lynch won with some kind of suplex. I forgot what it was. It must be her new finisher, though, because she won with it. I didn't write it down for whatever reason, so I don't remember what it was. It was good enough to get the win. Some other notes, though, on Lynch. She was actually trained by Prince Devitt, the same Prince Devitt who is likely NXT-bound in August. So that's a little weird, getting signed and making your big debut before the guy who actually trained you. But if she was trained by Prince Devitt, the woman can't be anything less than good. However, she has had a bunch of bad injuries in her career, which could be a red flag. She's broken both of her ankles, and she suffered a really bad head injury. It was a match in Germany back in 06. Her opponent apparently fell on top of her, and she damaged her cranial nerve, kept her out for a couple of years. She was supposed to come back, I think, in 08, but then instead she ended up retiring, and she resurfaced a few years after that in the Shimmer promotion. She was managing a young lady by the name of Brittany Knight. You may know her as Paige. So those two have a history together. So that's a little background on Becky Lynch. Colin Cassidy beat Sawyer Fulton in about a minute after a big boot and a standing elbow drop. He got some pretty good height on that elbow drop for a seven-footer. Out comes the Legionnaires after the match, Sylvester Lefort and Marcus Louis. But before they can pounce on the big man, out comes the returning Enzo Amore. How you doing? He's back. Enzo called himself and Cassidy a couple of certified G's. He called the French dudes soft. And that was that. The crowd ate it up. So good to have Enzo back. This looked to set up a feud, or at least it looked like it was setting up at least a tag team match with the Frenchman. But I read that Marcus Louis is out with a pretty serious injury, which I assume happened after this was taped. So that may not happen after all. There's been a lot of NXT injuries lately. There's a couple of divas out with knee injuries. Corey Graves has been out with a second concussion. I don't know that WWE is going to want to put him back in the ring again after that. I mean, I don't want to say that it's, you know, he's done or anything like that, but there have been rumors of possible NXT cuts coming as part of these budget cuts, and if I were him, I would be worried. Speaking of injuries, Tyler Breeze was out for the main event to replace Alex Riley on commentary, as if there wasn't already enough reasons to love that guy. They did not acknowledge it here, but I think it may have happened after these tapings. Breeze is also hurt. I think he broke a finger, or I read that he broke his hand, but it may have been a finger, because there have been pictures of him. He's been popping up on some of the NXT house shows, not wrestling, but he's got like a splint on his hand or whatever, you know, whatever it is. So hopefully it's nothing too serious. He joined Rich Brennan and Renee Young in the booth, and I love Renee Young. I really do. She's beautiful. She's got a real personality, not the personality of a paperclip like Devin Taylor when she does those backstage interviews. But on commentary, not her best week. And I thought Breeze was good, you know, reacting to Renee's questions, but she just paid no attention to the match between Adrian Neville and Rob Van Dam. That's a big main event, too. Adrian Neville and Rob Van Dam are in the main event of this show, and Renee Young is on commentary asking Tyler Breeze how many followers he has on Instagram. It's like all this nonsense. And even Breeze is like, stop with the annoying questions. Just, it really took away from the main event. Neville and Van Dam had a good match. Five-star frog splash missed. Allowed Neville to go up top, hit the red arrow for the clean pin right in the middle. And I'll tell you what, that win meant more for Neville than any of those matches with Brodus Clay did. When the match was over, Van Dam shook his hand. He endorsed him. Neville celebrated. And Tyler Breeze stood up on top of the announce desk for a stare down. And they went off the air. They have not teased when that match is going to take place between Neville and Breeze. Obviously, they're waiting for Breeze, I guess, now to heal up. But that's a match I'm looking forward to. I really am, because they've had matches before, great chemistry together, and very much looking forward to that match when it finally happens. So Renee Young aside, she had a bad night. Whatever they told her to do, she went overboard with it. It took away from the main event. It was still a good match. A good episode. Not as good as in recent weeks, but there was some good stuff on there. And very happy to see Colin Cassidy and Enzo Amore back. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's another way to show your support for The Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. We have an absolutely huge TNA segment this week. There's a lot of stuff to get to. Obviously, I'm going to be giving my thoughts on the tapings from Friday night at the Manhattan Center. But just a word of warning, if you do not want to know anything that happens on Impact over the next 2 months, because that's how far ahead they've now taped, then this is not the segment for you, but it's unavoidable. I have to get into this stuff. So I'm just warning you. And I would also encourage you to go ahead and check out my Instagram. I caved. I knew I was going to the show on Friday night, and so I thought maybe if I was going to upload any videos, Instagram would be the way to do it. So there is an official Solomonster Instagram account now. It's instagram.com/thesolomonster, all one word. And if you go to that link, there are some photos. There's a couple of videos that I shot at the Manhattan Center on Friday night. So if you want to check that out, you can subscribe to me there and go take a look at that. But before I get into any of the stuff from the Manhattan tapings, I want to just talk a little bit about Impact that aired on Thursday night. It was a tape show from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. They taped a whole bunch of shows in Pennsylvania. And I think this was the second one. Coming off the show where Lashley beat Eric Young to become the new TNA World Heavyweight Champion. And so I thought this show overall was fine. I probably liked the show better the week before. But there was stuff to like on this show. The big angle was Kurt Angle being introduced as the new, I think they called him the executive director. And I know, just what we need, another new authority figure in TNA. But they brought him in to replace MVP. So MVP is no longer the director of wrestling operations. He has lost power to Kurt Angle, which I guess is just something for Angle to do and to be on TV as he convalesces from his knee injury. Although I have to tell you, I watched Angle here and I listened to what he said in the final segment. He cut a little promo there before MVP and his goons came out to confront him. And no passion at all. Just, he's there reciting a bunch of words, which tells me that in his mind, he's probably as good as gone when his contract is up in a couple of months. I guess time will tell, because WWE has to go both ways, right? They have to want him back. But that kind of struck me as I listened to him speak here. It's just a role. It's a role for him on TV. He's kind of playing the string out until his contract comes due, and that's when things will probably get interesting. But Bobby Roode's promo to me was another high point of the show. Roode came out to, I think he came out again to save Eric Young is what happened when Lashley and Kenny King and MVP were putting the boots to him. So they bailed. And now Eric Young is in the ring alone with Bobby Roode, and Roode gets on the mic, and he cuts this great old-school promo. He talks about how he and Eric Young go back 20 years. They signed their TNA contracts on the same day, and he just went on and talked about MVP suspending him all those weeks ago, 7 weeks ago, and what bullshit it was, and they bleeped out bullshit. And I thought this was one of the best promos I've ever seen Bobby Roode cut. I thought it was great. And I wanted to mention it here because I thought it was worth bringing up. What happened was a lawyer, was he a lawyer or somebody from the TNA board of directors came out to inform MVP that he had been stripped of his power. And so Bobby Roode says, well, let me get this straight. That means that he no longer has any power over me, nor can he fire me, which MVP was about to do. And the guy said, that's right. And the crowd knew exactly what was about to happen, and they started chanting, kick his ass, kick his ass. And that's what Bobby Roode did. He hauled off. He decked MVP right in the face. He hit a crippled man. It's kind of like SummerSlam all those years ago when Bret Hart hit the coach who was in Mr. Perfect's corner, and Bobby Heenan just lost it. He couldn't believe that Bret Hart had struck a man wearing glasses. It's kind of what that reminded me of. But I just have to give Bobby Roode props. I am a big Bobby Roode fan. I was more a fan of his as a heel. I think as a babyface now, he'll get over just fine. He's already over. He's easily the number two babyface in the company now behind Bully Ray. And hopefully the title will find its way back to him at some point. I think he deserves another shot with it. And the other person who impressed me on this show, worth mentioning here, was EC3. Ethan Carter had a brawl with Tommy Dreamer. Dreamer attacked him backstage. They brawled from the back, down the aisle, into the ring before finally people came out to break it up. I don't know what the hell took them so long. Kind of like a hockey fight, only in hockey they let you fight for like 10 seconds and then they break you up. In TNA, they'll let you go for 10 minutes before anybody lifts a finger to stop what's going on out there. So they had a brawl and it was fine for what it was. But, you know, I'm watching this and just his overall performance of late, and even at the tapings, which I'll get into on Friday night, I have become a big fan of EC3. I really did. And it's another example of a guy that WWE let go, who they really could have done something with. I'm not saying that he was the next World Heavyweight Champion. He had the potential to be. But here's a guy who was doing nothing. They did nothing with him. He was on NXT back when NXT was a joke on the Sci-Fi Channel, and they had them doing stupid, silly competitions. You know, he was Derek Bateman back then. And, you know, maybe he just wasn't showing it the way that he's been showing it in TNA, but why the disparity then? You know, you can't say that in NXT he was terrible, but in TNA he actually has something. I mean, unless he found it somewhere along the way, I think that they just never gave him a shot. Clearly he had something, and they never got it out of him. They never exploited it. They never gave him a chance. Again, I think he was like a joke. He was like a comedy character, if I remember correctly, back during the NXT days. So he's an example of a guy who WWE dropped the ball on, and TNA gave him a shot. They gave him an opportunity. I think they've kept him undefeated this whole time. He got a push as Dixie Carter's nephew, so he was always prominently featured in some way. He started out facing nothing but scrubs, and it got to the point where it was like, this guy's a giant pussy. He just comes out every single week. He wrestles scrubs. When are they actually going to do something with him? And it wasn't until they finally put him in the ring with Sting and they started giving him some real competition that he started to show, you know, the character started to show that he actually can hang with these guys, and he doesn't just run away from people all the time. And we've seen him in some rough matches, you know, and he's been in there with Kurt Angle, and he's bled, and he's taken some abuse, and, you know, he's taken his lumps. And I think as a heel, at least, he's gotten over as somebody that the people genuinely hate, and the people want to see this guy get his ass kicked. But he's also developed a mean streak, going from being a pussy when he first came in and ducking challenges left and right to a guy that will go toe-to-toe with you. And, you know, he's got that mean streak now, and I've really become a fan of the character. And I find him and Spud, in particular, the two of them together, very entertaining. So I more often than not, I enjoy the interplay between the two of them, especially when he fires up Spud. It's always fun. So I've become a big EC3 fan. I really think there's something there with this guy, and I think WWE dropped the ball. They could have done more with him. They never gave him a chance. And that's why, you know, people will say, oh, you want TNA to fail. All you do is bash TNA. I don't bash TNA for the sake of bashing TNA. I bash TNA because they've done a lot of stupid shit. And more often than not, the people in charge there don't know what the hell they're doing. But every now and then, and I think I've used this expression before, a blind squirrel will find a nut. And that's what they did with EC3. They actually handled the guy very well. From the moment he came into the company, they gave him a big debut. They gave him, you know, his theme song is kind of major league. One of the better ones, I think, in the company. Big entrance when he comes out. And that's important because you want to make him into a big deal in order for the people to perceive him as being a big deal. So there's a big difference when EC3 comes out for his entrance, let's say, as opposed to Tigre Uno. As there should be. There should be a difference between the two of them. So yeah, I've become a big fan of EC3. And yeah, he had a fun brawl with Dreamer. Got broken up. And Willow and Abyss took on Magnus and Bram in a Monsters Ball match. This was just mayhem, lots of weapons. Jeff Hardy is a crazy man. I knew that after the tapings this week in New York. I mean, the guy took a Swanton bomb onto the ring steps the first night of the tapings. And, you know, some of the moves even in the match that I saw him in. And here what happened was they had a spot set up. Now, there's not a lot of wiggle room outside the ring. between the barricade and the ring. It's not like in WWE where you could have a match outside the ring. There's really not a lot of room out there. And they set up a chair that was laid out across from the top of the railing, I think, and the apron. Okay, so there's like a chair bridge, if you want to call it that. And there's a barbed wire board with some fake barbed wire on the outside, which was different than the very real barbed wire that I saw in New York. This was clearly the fake stuff. I didn't see Jeff cut up or anything like that. But he went up to the top rope. They threw a chair at his head. So I guess technically it was a chair shot to the head. And it knocked him off the top, and he took a header through the chair down through the barbed wire board. But there wasn't a lot of room between the railing and the ring. So at first when I watched it, I thought, holy shit, this guy just took a bad bump into the steel barricade. I think he just barely missed it. I think he went straight down through the chair. Everything went according to plan, but it was just such a dangerous stunt. And I'm just thinking to myself, this guy is, he's not getting any younger. And he's just going to kill himself out there. He's going to end up in a wheelchair in 10 years. And it's kind of sad to watch. But at the same time, he's out there breaking his back for a company that I don't think deserves it. And I give him credit for that. He goes out there. He doesn't half-ass it. He's like, if I'm going to go out there, I'm going to give these guys a show. I'm going to go 100%. I'm going to do what Jeff Hardy does, all the crazy shit that I do. I'm going to go do it because I work for TNA, and that's my job. And I respect him for it. It just makes me cringe when I see him take bumps like that. I thought as a garbage brawl, it was fine for what it was, if you're into that kind of stuff. So overall, there was some good stuff on this show. I'm not going to get into everything else that happened. Let's move on to New York. This was a big week for TNA, one of the most important weeks in the history of the company, without question. And I did a whole column, a long column for PW Mania earlier in the week, laying it on the line here, laying the whole thing out. This is what TNA has to do. They have to go to New York. They have to hit a home run. They have to change things around. They have to be different. They have to just go out there, give the people what they want, which is good wrestling, good action, good stories, have things that make sense, less talking, less Dixie, all of those things. And they have to do that, because if not, they may not have another chance. Here's a company that has gotten chance after chance after chance, and now they've been gifted another chance to come to New York in front of those people and knock it out of the park. And they have to take advantage of that because it could be their last chance. They still have no TV deal for the fall. They're doing another set of tapings in August. So basically, once these Pennsylvania shows are done airing, and I think July 10th may be the final one, it's all New York for the rest of the summer because they taped two shows each of the three nights. They're coming back to New York for another two shows for three straight nights. So the entire summer is going to be from the Manhattan Center Grand Ballroom in New York. And this is the last impression that people are going to have of TNA before the fall season. And by then, I would certainly hope they have a new TV deal with Spike already secured. I think they will, but they still don't have one. So this was a big deal for this company. And looking back on it, I didn't go to the first two nights of tapings. Again, I went to the final night of tapings. I think they did just that. I think they did exactly what they needed to do. They went out there. They had a bunch of kick-ass shows. And they did everything that they had to do to make a good impression on the fans in New York. And I just, my only hope is that these shows translate well to television. You never really know how it's going to translate, how they're going to edit it. Of course, they're going to shove in all their pre-tapes, and the pre-tapes could ruin the show. I don't think they will. But you never know what's going to happen when it comes to that kind of stuff. Because we didn't see any of the pre-tapes. There was none of that. And it actually kind of felt to me like they may have even been taping some things out of order. I'm not entirely sure in what order everything's going to air. They would open with a match, and they would take a break, and Jeremy Borash would talk to us and get the crowd all hyped up, and then they would immediately go to the next match, and one after the other, like that. So what they add in after the fact, I have no idea. But let's just go and start from the beginning of the week, because TNA made another big announcement on Wednesday. At a press conference, they announced that Bound for Glory this year is going to be taking place October 12th from Korakuen Hall in Tokyo, Japan, a building that fits about 2,000 people. And it's going to be a joint show with Great Muda's Wrestle 1 promotion. Great Muda was there. He was with Dixie Carter at the press conference. I'm not sure about a company that is short on money traveling halfway around the world to run a pay-per-view for 2,000 people. And depending on the setup of the building, you got to figure it's going to be probably set up for less than that. But that is one thing that I do like about TNA and Ring of Honor. They're similar in that way because, you know, they're number two and number three, whatever order you want to put them in. Okay, they're the number two and number three wrestling promotions in this country. They're more open to partnering with other promotions, whether it's a joint show or a talent exchange or whatever. So we end up with those ROH New Japan shows, you know, which were awesome. And TNA has worked with Triple A and with Wrestle One. Even Jeff Jarrett, you know, Jeff Jarrett's Global Force Wrestling promotion is, we haven't heard much of late about them, but they're going forward. They're preparing for their big debut later this year, early next year. And Jarrett just announced that GFW has also announced a partnership with New Japan Pro Wrestling. I guess Japan is in vogue these days. WWE does not have to work with anybody else because they're so damn big. But I think it would freshen up their shows if they did every now and then. Keep an open mind. Have an open relationship with different companies all over the world. You don't think that every company in the world would be clamoring to work with WWE and would be probably willing to acquiesce to at least some of their demands, whatever form that relationship may take. Of course they would. It's good exposure for them. And let's be honest, so many of these companies are so damn small. WWE can work with them, and it's not like they're you know, going to give them so much business it's going to take away from WWE and they're going to create a monster that's going to become big and compete with them. It's not going to happen. They're so far ahead of everybody else in terms of just the sheer size of the company. They could work with the little guy every now and then if they wanted to. I get why they don't do it. They have to own everything. You know, guys come in who don't belong to them and then leave 3 months later. What good does it do them if they get over here and then they lose them? So I get that. But that's what I like about the smaller promotions. There's more variety there, variety of styles. That's something WWE has no tolerance for. It's their way or no way. So it's a big deal. You know, they're going to Japan, and again, I don't know that it really serves a purpose other than it makes TNA feel a little more major league, and that's important because TNA does not feel major league right now, and perception is reality. So anything they could do like that, I'm cool with, and I think it's a cool thing. I just question whether or not it makes any sense to be doing that at a time when they're cutting costs and they're cutting people left and right because they just don't have the money to do it, unless Wrestle One is footing the bill for the production aspect, which they might be. It's a joint show, so it's possible Wrestle One maybe is handling the production aspect of things, and TNA just has to fly all of its talent out there. I don't know. But yeah, TNA's beaten WWE to the punch here. You have people still complaining that they won't bring WrestleMania to the UK, and TNA is bringing its WrestleMania over to Japan. So I don't think that's going to make WWE any more or less likely to come to the UK for a WrestleMania. You know, with the network, I think it would be foolish not to have like a SummerSlam maybe, or a Royal Rumble from the UK at some point. You know, with the network, you may as well just try it. You know, can't hurt. Fast forward to Thursday night, Dixie Carter went through a table at the TNA tapings. I said months ago when they started this angle, New York City was the place to do it. If they were building to it and the woman was going to take a bump, if she had to do it, New York was the place to do it, and then you blow it off and you get her the hell off TV. And she took the bump. There was video that popped up online of it. Took it like a champ, and she may have been legitimately injured on that table bump. You watch the video and, you know, Bully did everything he could. I mean, he totally protected her. It was more Bully's ass that went through the table than Dixie herself. But she's a 50-year-old woman who has no business taking bumps. So, you know, what do you expect? Even Mae Young, when Mae Young took those bumps from Bully Ray, from Bubba Ray back in the day, and at that point, Mae was in her 70s or 80s. At the same time, though, Mae was a trained wrestler for so many years. She knew what she was doing. She knew how to fall, how to position her body, and again, she was protected as well. Dixie doesn't have any sort of formal training. She's not a wrestler. She's never been a wrestler. She never will be a wrestler. And she's a 50-year-old woman. So it's not all that surprising that she may have been hurt. I don't know what the injury is. It may have been an old back injury that was aggravated. I read somewhere that it may have been a concussion. I don't know if that's what it was. But apparently she wasn't even backstage at the final tapings on Friday. She definitely did not appear on camera, for which I was thankful. TNA did the right thing for a change. They really did. You know, they gave the people what they wanted in the absolute right place to do it. Bully's hometown, a lot of rabid New York City fans just dying to see him put this woman through a table. And he did it, and it sounds like it was done as a way to keep her off television indefinitely. It could be, at least for now, a write-off for the Dixie Carter character. And it sounds like that is the plan. And to that I say, it's about damn time. It just wrote itself. Woman goes through a table, big bump, right? She shouldn't be popping back up on TV 2 weeks later. So now we get Dixie-free television going forward once these tapings finally air. We still have many more weeks of Dixie on television. But at least we know now, once this angle airs, we don't have to put up with her on television. Her character was so played out. And there were aspects of it that she played well. She would go some places and have great heat, but the character was so unbearable. And it was taking up so much time on television, and she really just had no business being there. And took up so many segments of just complete nonsense and authority figure bullshit that it's about damn time. Which takes us to the tapings on Friday night. These were the tapings that I went to. Brian Blade joined me, and I had a freaking blast. I don't think I've ever not had fun at a TNA live event, but these were my first Impact tapings. And coming off the worst collection of tapings in that company's history, you know, I was a little worried. But they knew what they had to do. They had something to prove. They knew they had to hit a home run, and they hit a grand slam. One of the most fun experiences that I've had at a wrestling show. Now, I'm sure part of that had to do with the front row seats. I don't normally sit front row at these shows, but we were able to get front row tickets, and that always helps. But what made it great was, A, no Dixie and no Willow. Willow and Dixie both made appearances, or at least Dixie did. I don't know if Willow did. He might have. But there was no Dixie and no Willow on these final tapings, so that was important. But B, there was a little bit of everything on the shows. You know, you like good wrestling? You got that. You like fast action with the X Division? You got that. You like the hardcore garbage stuff with weapons and blood and thumbtacks and barbed wire? You got that in the opening match of the taping between Abyss and Bram. You like nostalgia? You got that with the Hardys and the Dudleys. They brought back a whole bunch of people. It felt like a big-time match, the Hardys and Dudleys did, in that it was a big-time match. You know, it may have been the last match between those two teams we ever get to see. And we got to see it. It felt special. One thing that was weird was not being privy to all the results of the earlier tapings. So guys would come out, and they were referencing stuff that happened the night before, or two nights before, or from the Bethlehem tapings that hasn't aired yet. You know, I mean, they're still airing those Impacts from Pennsylvania until July 10th. So, for instance, Gail Kim walked out with the Knockouts title on her shoulder, and it's like, when the hell did she win the belt back? You know, or even better than that, Sam Shaw and Mr. Anderson were tag team partners in one of the matches on the show. Now, granted, they weren't willing partners. They're not best friends. But still, it's like, what the fuck is going on here? Didn't take away from my enjoyment of the show. It's hard to get into the stories when you missed a few chapters. So that was one of the things that I noticed. Crowd on Friday night was sold out. From what I read, 1,200 was the number. Whatever the number was, whether it was 1,200, 900, it was packed. So they definitely had plenty of people there. It's a small venue. I mean, the ballroom upstairs, which I used to go to for Ring of Honor shows, it's the same ballroom that Raw was taped in when Raw first came on the air in 93. The Hammerstein ballroom is downstairs on the first floor. That building can fit, I think, up to maybe 2,500 with the setup for wrestling. So still a very intimate venue, but a lot bigger. So at least they were able to fill the smaller one, because there were a lot of reports that they weren't even able to come close to selling out the tapings. And it wasn't until the week of the events that they finally did sell out night number two, and they sold out. I think the third night was the first one to sell out. The second one sold out right before the show. So at least they were able to do that. We got a couple of explosion matches. Madison Rayne beat Brittany with a forward roll. The Wolves beat the Bromans. First taping opened with a Monsters Ball match. So we just saw a Monsters Ball match on Impact air this week, and all of a sudden we're getting another one. Bram and Abyss, these poor fuckers. These guys beat the shit out of each other. They just ripped each other open with weapons. Abyss took, maybe it was Bram, who actually brought a barbed wire board out from under the ring. He set it up in the corner. Janice, the nail-filled board, was out there, and you know, there was chairs, there was garbage cans, there were tables, there was a wrench or whatever that instrument is that they used to put the ring ropes up. So they had a brawl. They had one of those garbage brawls, and what I couldn't believe was at one point, Abyss, he brushed up against the barbed wire board, and his arm was all cut up. All of a sudden, his arm was bleeding, and I'm thinking to myself, this motherfucker using real barbed wire on this show, why? Why would you do that? You know what I mean? I mean, I know, you know, some of the fans are bloodthirsty, and that's just how they are, but I was watching this, and I'm thinking to myself, this fucking guy is going to tear his shit up for real, with real barbed wire, for what? It's just a throwaway match on Impact. You know, you could have the same effect if you have the fake barbed wire out there, and, you know, if Abyss is, let's say, slammed on it, he wears a shirt, so if he doesn't bleed, it's not as big of a deal. Let's say he puts Bram through it, Bram's out there without a shirt on. Yeah, it might look weird if he hits the barbed wire and doesn't get all cut up, but I don't know, I just thought that was stupid. He just kind of brushed up against it, and his whole arm was all cut up, and I was like, oh, God. But then the thumbtacks came out, and Bram took a bump on the thumbtacks, and I saw that, I guess, Magnus did on Impact. He took a chokeslam bump onto the thumbtacks, and I thought his facials when he got slammed were great. Probably didn't have to exaggerate much, because I imagine that doesn't feel too good to be body slammed on thumbtacks. Bram took the same bump here, and immediately his back was bleeding, and just, it was brutal. Just absolutely brutal. And I think Bram won. Pretty sure that Bram won in the end. So, yeah, just watching this was a spectacle, especially because it was the first match of the taping. So, like, the show starts, and all of a sudden, there's guys bleeding, and there's weapons, and it's like, wow. How are you going to top this? MVP was out next on crutches with Lashley, Kenny King, and a bunch of random women. I'm sure it was no accident they sent three black dudes out there with a horde of white women. Way to play up that stereotype. Lashley, by the way, is absolutely enormous in person. Just a huge man. A monster of a man. MVP said there was no competition left for Lashley. That brought out Bobby Roode, who is, you know, when you see him in person, he's got that mohawk-type haircut. I don't know that it works so well. I'm sure there's a name for it. I would never in a million years ask for a haircut like that, so I have no interest in looking it up, but whatever it's called, it doesn't really suit him well. They all ended up attacking Bobby Roode, which led to Eric Young and Austin Aries making the save. That set up a six-man tag for later in the show. Bromans and DJ Zima beat Mr. Anderson, Gunner, and Sam Shaw. Those must be some amazing pre-tapes that haven't aired yet to explain this one. The way this all played out, with Anderson wanting nothing to do with Shaw and Gunner trying to make peace between them, and then Sam Shaw actually got the hot tag at one point. He started to run wild on the heels, and Anderson was the one who got rolled up for the finish. So when you look at this whole thing, I could see this becoming a double turn scenario where people start to slowly turn on Anderson while Shaw gets over as a babyface. I have no idea if that's where they're going, but that was what I got coming out of these tapings. That would not be the last time we would see these men either. Actually, the person we saw the most of anybody on this night was Zema Ion. He was out there for an explosion match in the corner of the Bromans. He was out there in this match wrestling, and then he was out again later on for an X Division scramble. Dude was everywhere. Beautiful people came out. Angelina was missing her title, so I figured she must have lost it somewhere along the way. And sure enough, Gail Kim came out with the belt to confront them. And Taryn Terrell was out there. Gail said that she would defend her title against all of them, Angelina, Velvet, and Taryn. I'm not sure when, because it did not happen on this night. Broke down into a brawl. Babyfaces ran off the heels. So, yeah, there you go. Bully Ray and Velvet Sky are an item now, apparently. That's what he said on the Opie and Anthony show. Good for him. I look at that and I just think to myself, what an odd pairing. Bully Ray and Velvet Sky. Wow. Then we got a really good match. Sonata, Samoa Joe, and Low Ki for the X Division title. Loki is back in TNA, and he is using that name. He is not using the Senshi name that he used last time. Kind of like Austin Aries. You know, when Austin Aries first came to TNA, they called him Austin Starr. Then he left, came back, and was using the name that he always used, Austin Aries. Same thing with Loki. So he looked good. Joe tapped out Sonata with the choke. He won the X Division title. So Samoa Joe is your new X Division champion. Place popped huge for that. Bully Ray was out next. Great reaction from the crowd. He brought out D-Von. Matt and Jeff Hardy ended up coming out. So we had the Hardys and the Dudleys in the ring. And of course people wanted... They kept chanting TLC. And it was funny because I'm watching them in the ring. I'm watching D-Von in particular. And D-Von's got this reaction like, no, no, no. Because they were not having a TLC match. But, you know, they were talking about like the past wars that they've had. And they specifically brought up the table matches and the TLC matches. So it was only natural that the crowd would chant for that, but they set up a main event, Hardys against Dudleys, felt like a big-time match. It's a match we have not seen in a number of years, and, you know, again, two teams that helped revolutionize tag team wrestling at a time when tag team wrestling was kind of stagnant, and at the very end of 99 into 2000, Edge and Christian, the Hardys and the Dudleys, they did it. You know, they brought tag team wrestling back from the abyss, they made it fun to watch again, and for a while there in 2000, you had a tag team division that was a hell of a lot of fun. You had those guys, and the Radicals came in. You had the APA. You had Too Cool. I'm sure there's a few others I'm forgetting. Even the Outlaws, the New Age Outlaws, were still doing some teaming around that time. Rock and Sock Connection. So anyway, so that was a big time main event. People were very into it that they set up there. Lashley, Kenny King, and MVP beat Bobby Roode, Austin Aries, and Eric Young. After Lashley speared Aries inside out to get the pin, MVP came to the ring on one crutch. He was all suited up in his wrestling gear, ready to go. So I imagine his knee injury is healing well. Otherwise, if not, it was stupid for him to be out there wrestling. He didn't do much, but why take the risk? One other just quick note here that I noticed, because we're in the front row, and the baby faces are... Because again, they're using the six-sided ring. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention that. The six-sided ring is back, and it didn't seem like guys were having too much trouble adjusting to it or wrestling in it. I mean, then again, I was there on the last night, so they had already been wrestling in the ring for multiple tapings the previous 2 days. I'm sure they got used to it. And there are people in the company who were there for the first several years, and so they know how to work in that kind of ring. It did sound a lot louder than I remember it sounding when guys would get slammed and take bumps to where it actually made me hurt, so hopefully... It didn't hurt them too much. But the baby faces were on the apron on our side, right in front of us. And Eric Young got knocked out of the ring at one point, so he's just kind of out there leaning against the apron. And I'm looking at this guy. The back knee on this guy was disgusting. It's just like, I couldn't look away. I'm looking at this guy, and I'm like, God, this guy just got back knee all over himself. Anyway, EC3 was out. Dressed up in a suit, his head was all bandaged because he got cut open hard way the night before. Had to go have a whole bunch of staples put in his head. So he was out there not looking very happy at all over what happened to his Aunt Dixie the night before. Rockstar Spud was out there with him. He also was not in a good mood. They came out to the ring with Rhino. So again, one of those things where I'm watching this going, what the hell is Rhino out there doing with Spud? And EC3, obviously something happened at the tapings the night before, or maybe the night before that. No idea if Rhino turned on Dreamer or Bully or what happened. The thing about Rhino was inexplicably out there wearing flip-flops. The man-beast in flip-flops. Maybe they can edit some boots onto his feet in post-production. He looked ridiculous. EC3 demanded that Bully Ray be terminated immediately from TNA for putting his Aunt Dixie through a table. Kurt Angle came out, and he is the new authority figure in TNA because we don't have enough of those. He called the cops to the ring to arrest them for refusing to vacate the premises. Spud was hilarious here. He was standing up to the cops. He called them a bunch of donut eaters, and they just all tackled him to the ground. EC3 tried to pay off the cops, tried to bribe them, threw a bunch of money in their face. They cuffed him anyway and hauled him off. And when he left the ring, Kurt Angle picked up one of those $20 bills off the mat and handed it to a little kid in the front row. Then we got Mr. Anderson against Gunner. And this is where the crowd started to get very restless. It was obvious that this was for the second taping now. They never said that. The crowd started amusing themselves with chants of "Let's go Cena, Cena sucks." They started singing the Adam Rose theme song. Then we got Ole Ole chants for Sami Zayn. They started a "We Are Awesome" chant, which just bugged the hell out of me. You know, it was amusing the first time when we did it in Jersey the night after WrestleMania last year. Now it's just stupid. Sam Shaw came out, he caused the DQ, crowd chanted "Thank you, Dexter" at him. Abyss was out for a promo, holding his ribs after being clubbed in the midsection with Janus earlier in the night. He called out Bram and Magnus, who now have Janus in their possession. Abyss challenged Bram to a Stairway to Janus match, where the board will be suspended 15 feet above the ring. Whoever gets it first can claim it as their own. Match is going to have tables, chairs, tacks, fire, glass, barbed wire. Bram accepted. Not sure why, but he accepted. And Abyss said that he would show them what a bitch Janus can be. Six-man X Division elimination scramble match. Low Key, Tigre Uno, Manic, DJ Zima, Crazy Steve from the Menagerie, and Homicide, who was back in TNA. A lot of the eliminations came in pretty rapid-fire succession, one after the other, but when it came down to Low-Key and Homicide, it got real good. Crowd was into it. I felt like I was back at a Ring of Honor show 7 years ago in that building. Homicide did a dive outside onto Low-Key at one point. Low-Key was outside, right by the metal barrier. And Homicide did a dive. He almost took out the entire front row. I mean, he knocked the barricade so far back, I was amazed that he didn't injure anybody in the front row and that he didn't kill himself. I'm stunned he didn't break his own neck the way he fell. But he popped right back up and he looked okay. So anyway, the match went on and Low-Key got the win. Main event was Team 3D against the Hardy Boys. 3D was out there wearing their old school Dudley Boys gear, including Bully was rocking the classic camo outfit. Crowd chanted "This is awesome" before they even touched. Lots of action here. Never a dull moment. You would think, okay, they'll go out there, they'll have a good match, maybe a little slow at the beginning. Nope, they went out there. It was pretty much action from start to finish. Some crazy moves, although nothing as crazy as Jeff Hardy doing a frickin' swanton onto the ring steps the first night. Guy's out of his mind. They all hit their signature spots. Dudley's did the wazap headbutt when they won with a 3D on Matt. After the match, they all shook hands, embraced in the middle of the ring. So basically, think about the click curtain call from 96. That's kind of what this looked like here. Bully got on the mic, said they were the last of a dying breed. Oh, apparently he and Bull Dempsey are both the last of a dying breed. He said there's one team in the back that can carry the torch for tag team wrestling, and called out the Wolves. Matt Hardy started to get emotional while cutting a promo on how he and Jeff and Bully and Devon and another team, you all know who they are, they all succeeded when they weren't supposed to, and they reinvigorated tag team wrestling, and he put over the Wolves real strong. It was actually a really good promo Matt Hardy cut here, and all of them, they all put the Wolves over as like the next big thing. It really felt like the passing of a torch in a lot of ways. We hear that expression thrown around a lot. That's really what this felt like. Bully got back on the mic. People were chanting ECW, and he actually basically said, "Listen, I appreciate when you guys do that, but what I want to hear you chant is three other initials," and they all started chanting TNA, and he got real serious for a second. He said, "You know, everybody in this company, the past is the past. They're here to bust their ass. They do it for the people." He said, "The last three nights were some of the best wrestling today that you're going to find. If you disagree, get the F out." And he called all the wrestlers that were still here in the back, told them all to come on down. And so all the baby faces came out. Simon Diamond, right? Pat Kenny came out. Al Snow, they were the agents there. They came out on stage. And I think it was Devon who got on the mic. And he said, "Hey, everybody, it's Al Snow's birthday. So let's all sing happy birthday to him." And everybody sang happy birthday. Al Snow was, he was up on stage. And he's like pointing at Devon like, "You motherfucker, I'm going to get you back." Because as it turns out, it wasn't even Al Snow's birthday. It's just a rib that Devon apparently was playing on him all day long. I think Al's birthday is next month. So it wasn't even his birthday, but everybody chanted, "Happy birthday, Al Snow." And then the wrestlers all went around ringside shaking hands and taking pictures and signing autographs and chit-chatting with the fans at ringside, and it was actually a really cool moment. It's the sort of thing that you, again, will find at a TNA show or even a Ring of Honor show, and WWE is just so damn big that you can't get that same kind of experience. So when you're there, when you're actually there, it's fun to be part of something like that. And all the knockouts came around. You could check the Instagram page. I put a video up when the knockouts were coming around right by us, and Madison Rain blew a kiss into the camera, and Taryn Terrell came walking by, and Rebel was there. I got a great shot of, I think it was Rebel, Madison, and Taryn up on the apron. They happened to be waving at the exact same moment. I think they were waving to the fans up in the balcony right above us, and I got a shot. It's my favorite photo from the night. It's just a perfect shot. So, just a lot of fun. I mean, a lot of fun. D-Von was coming around, and Brian Blade started talking to him, and if you can call it a scoop, I don't know if it's really much of a scoop or not, but, Brian kept telling him, listen, I hope you're back, want to see more of you, and hope you're sticking around, and D-Von was, I appreciate that, and actually that might just happen. So it sounds like D-Von is at least open to the idea of sticking around in TNA, and he may well be back. So I'm sure we haven't seen the last of him. If nothing else, obviously he and Bully are going into the Hall of Fame at Bound for Glory in October. We'll see them there. So it sounds like D-Von may not be done just yet. And that was it. That was the night. And all I could say is this. When you give people a great show, okay, when you give the people what they want to see, they reward you for it. I left feeling like I got my money's worth. When I bought my ticket to this show, I think I bought my ticket, it might have been the same week, at the beginning of May, that they taped those shows from Orlando. They taped like 6 or 7 weeks worth of television, and it was horrendous. Every show was worse than the one before it. And I was this close from just calling it quits because it was just so bad. They have so many talented guys, and it was just so bad. How can you just have such bad television? But again, I had already bought my ticket, and I wanted to go to the show, and Brian was coming with me, and I didn't know what to expect, but I was happy when it was over because it was quite the turnaround from what we have seen on television over the last month and a half. It was almost like a different company in a lot of ways. And like I said before, when you give the people what they want, they reward you for it. They're coming back for another set of tapings at the Manhattan Center in August, and I've already bought my ticket for the next show. I'm going to go back. They're coming back for 3 more shows, the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th, and I'll be hitting up the first taping on the 5th, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it a lot. I'm pretty sure these shows that we were at are not airing. I want to say August 14th and the 21st is when they're going to air. I could be off by a week on that. But yeah, they're not going to air until the middle of August, so you're not going to be seeing this stuff for a while. I'll probably be all over the damn show because we were right there. I mean, we're right in the front row, right by the ring steps where everybody was entering on the side there. So you'll be seeing my mug on TV, unless they decide to put a blue dot over my face, which is always possible. But thumbs up to TNA. Credit where credit is due. They came to New York. They conquered. They left. They had a great showing, a lot of momentum, a lot of positive feelings coming out of these tapings. They're coming back again in August, and hopefully they can fill the building up then, and whatever formula they use this time, maybe a little less on relying on bringing back old faces and just focus on what brought you to the dance, man. Put those X guys out there. Put out stories that are easy to follow with guys that people want to cheer for. Push guys like Joe. Push guys like Aries. Push guys like Bobby Roode. Even Eric Young, he was over with the crowd big time. And push, guys like Low Key and Homicide. If those guys are back, then those are the guys you want to have on the card in New York. And get other guys out there like Manic and Sonata and Tigre Uno and maybe bring in some other new fresh faces and just let them go out there and tear it up. That's the only way you're going to be able to win any sort of goodwill back from the people is by keeping all that garbage in the past and focusing on what brought you to the dance, which is a lot of good action that you will not see in WWE. Don't try to be something that you can never be. You can never be WWE. Don't be that. Be TNA. And that's what they did. These 3 nights, that's exactly what they did. And look what happened. It worked out for them. Let's move on to the mailbag now. If you have any questions for me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. We have a whole bunch of audio questions here, so we're going to started out with one from Kennedy in Orlando, Florida.
Solid Monster, what's up? It's your boy KC, Kennedy again. I want to talk about the last week's show when you was talking about Diesel and how he didn't have any credible heels during 1995 as the champion. And it got me thinking, had they have pushed the guy right the way they were supposed to, do you think that Owen Hart would have been a good challenge for Diesel? Because you remember back in 95, he was still a heel. You know, he still had his thing going on with Brett, even though it was not as big as it was in 94. Do you think that Owen would have been a good challenger for Diesel?
No, not really. Diesel and Owen as a feud in 95, I don't really think that would have been a big draw. I don't think that Owen was at that level at that point. You know, he had his main event run with Brett in 94. If they wanted to put the title on him then, I guess they could have, but they didn't. So he was kind of one level below that. You know, a Diesel-Owen feud to me, even looking back when I was younger, I don't think that would have worked. What would have worked is that Owen could have probably brought Diesel to some of the best matches he had that year. Believe me, Diesel would have had a much better match with Owen Hart than he would have with Mabel or Sid or Kama or any of those guys. So from a match perspective, sure, Owen was probably one of the best people on that roster who could have worked with Diesel. But as a feud for the title in 95, I don't really see it. Brad Gilmore sent in an audio question this week, too.
Hey, Solid Monster. Brad Gilmore here. I was sitting and thinking about some of the best and some of the worst kings in professional wrestling history. In your opinion, who are the best and who are the worst?
Well, I can't say King Booker was one of the worst because he'll come after me with his golf club. Brad and Booker played some golf last week. And apparently Booker schooled him. But no, actually, King Booker, I have to say, is one of the better kings that they've had in WWE history, at least. Because Booker was a guy who had been around for so long. You know, he had been on the roster for so many years. And he had success when he first came over. You know, he was the world heavyweight champion and that kind of stuff. But then he cooled off a little bit, and they weren't really doing much with him. When he won the crown, that really launched him back into the main event picture. It was a few months later that he, might have been right after he won the crown, that he became the world heavyweight champion again, and he was headlining pay-per-views against, you know, Batista. He was in the mix. You know, he was right there in that headline mix of guys, and it really reinvigorated his career. So in that respect, I think that he probably will go down as one of the better kings in wrestling history. Although I have to admit, it did get to the point, and maybe this was the point because he was a heel, but it got to the point where he and Charmel would make their entrance on SmackDown. And I think it was Charmel who would say, "All rise," or "All hail King Booker." But she would say it so many times, I would want to rip my ears off or just like sew them shut. I guess that was kind of the point. That got a little annoying after a while, but I would put King Booker on that list as one of the better kings in wrestling history. And of course, there's Jerry the King Lawler, something like 40 years in the business and 100 and something championships in Memphis. He had most of his success in Memphis, not so much in WWE, although I guess just him being in WWE as long as he has is a success all by itself. So Lawler would have to be probably at the top or near the top of your list of greatest kings. Harley Race was another one. You know, he came over from the NWA, and a lot of guys who would come over, and Dusty Rhodes was an example of this. They put him in the polka dots and probably didn't expect him to get over. He did anyway. But you never knew what was going to happen when you came over to work for Vince McMahon, if they were going to bury you, if they were going to mock you, if they were actually going to push you. Ric Flair was the great example of somebody, a top star, the top guy in the NWA, who came over. And yes, he was the chicken shit heel. He wasn't maybe quite the same, I don't say tough guy, really. But yeah, he would go toe-to-toe with you in the NWA. Whether he was in there with Sting, Flair, yeah, he would beg off and stuff because that's what heels did back then. But Flair was more of, I think, the chicken shit heel in WWE. But when he came over, he was right in the mix, man. He was right up in Hogan's face. He won the Royal Rumble, greatest Royal Rumble performance of all time, became the champion. And they really treated him the way that he should have been treated. They treated him like a champ. They treated him like a top guy. And they didn't, keep him in the mid-card. Harley Race is another example of a guy who was former NWA champion, what, six times, I think? And came over, and they put the crown on him, and they put him in a robe, and they made him the king. And you could argue on the one hand, what a goofy gimmick to give to one of the greatest legit tough guys in wrestling history. Now he comes over, he's wearing a purple robe, and he's the king of wrestling. But you know what? Back then, that was kind of a big gimmick, and they gave it to him. And he was prominently featured, and he had the feud with the Junkyard Dog. I know he wrestled Hulk Hogan a few times. I'd probably put Harley Race on there as one of the better kings. Of course, then there's the Macho King. How can I talk about greatest kings in wrestling without mentioning Randy Savage? That was kind of the second part of his career there in WWE. Once Elizabeth went away and they did the split, and Savage went back to being a heel, he aligned with Sensational Sherri. She was Queen Sherri. They would come out on the giant throne. He had the scepter. I love the Macho King. The Macho King gimmick I thought was great. I think he played it to a hilt. It was fantastic. It was awesome. So Macho King is at the top of my list. Then you had guys like King Haku. Not so much. King Hacksaw Jim Duggan. Even less. You have the King of Hearts. Owen Hart. He's got to be way up there. King Mabel. Not so much. He's probably way down on the list. That didn't work out too well. Then you start getting into other kings. You know, King Kong Bundy. Kenny King. How about the kings of wrestling? Claudio Castagnoli and Chris Hero. It's too bad they never had a run as a tag team in WWE. All right, we'll do two more of these. Here's one from Zach House of Pain Hulker.
Hey Solomonster, it's Zach House of Pain Hulker from Preston, England. I sent a question in a couple of weeks ago pitching the idea of a babyface Jack Swagger against Rusev. With Rusev not being in the Money in the Bank match, could you see an interference happening and Rusev costing Swagger the briefcase and the match?
No, and you know, I've gotten this question a few times, not so much about Money in the Bank, but what do I think of a Swagger-Rusev feud if Swagger were to go babyface and he's the real American, the all-American American, against the evil Bulgarian turned Russian, whatever they're billing him as this week. I could see that feud at some point because, you know, what do you do with Swagger after a while? Like I said earlier in the podcast, Swagger's had a tough run of late. He hasn't been doing much. He had a terrible match on Monday night. He injured Barrett at the SmackDown tapings on Tuesday night. I'm sure he felt bad about that. He's just kind of stuck in this rut right now. He's got Zeb, who's a great talker and very entertained by Zeb Coulter, but the act is growing very stale. And without Cesaro, because they had developed some really good tag team chemistry, and it's a hard thing to do because on the one hand, you want to keep them together. They were finding their rhythm as a tag team, and they could have had a run with the belt at some point, but you want to elevate Cesaro to that next level because he's so much better than just being in a tag team right now. So they broke him up, and I'm sure there's big things in his future, but then Swagger is kind of left in a lurch, and it's like, well, what do you do with the guy? Well, one way to freshen him up is probably to turn him babyface at some point. And it's going to be a question of how they do that. You have to do it in such a way where he can get the people behind him. He can't just show up one week and, you know, go after Rusev. There's got to be a reason for it. So yeah, I would like to see that feud at some point. I think once Rusev is finished with Big E, that might be a good time to get Swagger in there somehow, and that's kind of the next, you know, middle of the card or mid-level kind of feud you can have Rusev in. Rusev would win, because I think the idea here is to keep building him up and building him up probably for John Cena. So Swagger would just be another notch on his belt, but at least it would have, you know, it would be something different, you know, and people can get behind Swagger, and who knows, maybe he gets over better as a babyface than he ever did as a heel. I don't think he's ever been a babyface before, unless he was a babyface in developmental back in the FCW days, but otherwise he's been a heel this whole time, from ECW until where he is now. As far as Money in the Bank goes, do I see him interfering in that match and costing Swagger the match? No, I don't, because it wouldn't make any sense. He's already got a match on the card, and they've established absolutely nothing between him and Swagger. So you can do that, I guess, to kickstart a feud, but what's Rusev's reasoning for interfering in the match? You know, he's been on the roster for a few months now. It's not as though he's gone after Swagger. He hasn't had a problem with Swagger being on any of the other shows. So I think that would be kind of forced. I don't think that's going to happen at all. But a Swagger-Rusev feud, I wouldn't have a problem with that. And finally, we have an audio question from Nick in Chicago.
Hey, Sal Monster. My question's about The Rock. When most people talk about The Rock's role in WWE, they typically refer to his time in 2000 to 2003. A lot of people even go as far to say that The Rock's best heel gimmick was Hollywood Rock. But I would disagree. I think that The Rock's role in the corporation gets overlooked by a lot of people. He put on his best promos during that time, and I think that he put on some of his best wrestling, too. So my question to you is, do you feel like The Rock's role in the corporation gets overlooked? And when looking back on it, do you think that it was one of the best heels of the last 20 years, or even of all time?
That's a good question. Does his heel corporation run get overlooked? I would say it does, and part of that is probably because he wasn't in the corporation for that long. I mean, if you think about it, when he did the turn, they did that swerve at Survivor Series in 98. He won the belt and went on to feud with Mankind and then Austin. It was, I want to say it was the night after, not WrestleMania, it would have been the night after the Backlash pay-per-view that he got kicked out of the corporation. So his heel run as part of that group went from November of 98 to April of 99. Well, it's a decent amount of time, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it does get overlooked because he did so much stuff after that. He became such a bigger star as a babyface. And the Hollywood Rock thing was one of those deals where I think people were just so happy to see him back in that role. And at the time, he was already a movie star. Not as big as he is now, but he was already making movies. And the idea that he would go back to being a bad guy, I think, was kind of cool in a lot of people's eyes. And he embraced it. Like, he embraced the whole persona of being a Hollywood elitist. And he would come out wearing the leather vest and just trash talk people. It was so great. But the idea of him as the best heel of all time, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, one of the best heels of the last 20 years. Yeah, I mean, he'd be on that list. I enjoyed the hell out of him. I guess the thing is, it depends on how you like your heels in pro wrestling, how you like your bad guys, because if you want a really vicious SOB with no redeeming qualities whatsoever, who isn't out there to entertain, he's out there to be a heel. He's out there to be a dick. He wants to piss you off and wants you to pay money to see him get his ass kicked and all that kind of stuff. He's not out there to tell jokes and stuff like that. That's the kind of heel that Triple H was. That's the kind of heel that Edge was on SmackDown when he tried. He tried to have no redeeming value at all. He didn't want his merchandise to be sold. Jericho. Chris Jericho in 2008 in maybe his best incarnation ever, and he had those awesome matches with Shawn Michaels. That's the kind of heel that he was. And you can go back in wrestling history and find a multitude of other examples of that. The Rock was not that kind of heel. The Rock was, in a lot of ways, a cool heel who the people always cheered for. Maybe not always, but a good part of his run, they cheered him. And the reason he turned babyface back so quickly was because people wanted to cheer the guy. You know, go back. Here's what I remember. When The Rock lost the Intercontinental title to Triple H in that ladder match at SummerSlam in 98, place went crazy for Triple H when he won the belt. Okay, that was when Rock was still part of the Nation. I remember that night, because at the time they had this agreement with the Home Shopping Network where WWE would air like half hour, maybe it was an hour, half hour, whatever it was, these specials on the Home Shopping Network, and they would sell their shit. And some wrestlers would come by, and The Rock came by. And this was right after the ladder match. And he was so entertaining. And that's when I really started to notice that people were starting to get behind the guy. Even though he lost, it meant so much to him to help get him over and elevate him to that next level that he got over more than Triple H did. Now, Triple H went away because he suffered a knee injury, but The Rock got over more in defeat than he probably ever would have if he would have won that match. And he became a babyface, but then again, it was all a big swerve, and he went back to being a heel again in November. But I think there were always people who wanted to cheer for the guy, and just based on his promos and the stuff he would say and the catchphrases and everything else, I don't know if that was his intent. I'm not saying he wanted to get himself over as a babyface, but it just kind of happened that way. So is that the definition of one of the greatest heels of all time? I don't know. I liked him. I loved heel Rock back in the corporate days and Hollywood Rock. I loved it. I loved it better than I liked a good chunk of Rock as a babyface. But I don't know that I would necessarily put him on my list of top five heels of all time. Maybe not even top 10. Maybe. I'd have to sit and think about that. One of the most entertaining, absolutely. Without question. But I think we have to kind of look at it from a, you know, a different perspective there, because people will have different definitions of what they see in a hero and what they see in a villain. And Rock was never... I never got the impression that Rock was hated that much. I never really got that sense. And I thought Rock maybe was at his most heelish when he bludgeoned Mick Foley to death almost in that Royal Rumble match. I mean, he was a sick SOB in that match. And even Foley was not too happy with Rock, I guess, backstage, because Rock never bothered to come find him and check up on him. And I mean, Foley got his brains bashed in that night. And that was one of the more uncomfortable moments that I think I've ever had as a fan in WWE, watching a match. So that was when Rock was really at his most vicious, but it was rare. Like, I don't look at Rock as being a vicious heel, you know what I mean? In that match, he was. But, you know, greatest heel of all time, that I'm not sure about. All right, let's get into some of the other questions here. This comes from Tom. WWE is known for punishing wrestlers who get injured during a big push, like Dolph Ziggler or Christian. Do you think the McMahons are offended that Daniel Bryan got injured after his huge push? Do you think that Bryan will be punished once he returns to a full-time schedule? Will he ever be awarded another opportunity like this ever again? I wouldn't use the word punish. I don't think they're punishing anybody on purpose for getting hurt. I just think it's a case where guys get hurt and they kind of lose faith in them. They think they're soft, or they think that in some way they've let down the company by getting hurt at an inopportune time, or they just lose interest. Maybe they're pushing somebody like Fandango, who was getting a big push at the time, and he got hurt, and there were rumors that he was going to win the Intercontinental title. I remember Steve Austin on his podcast around WrestleMania time last year proclaiming that within 6 months, Fandango was going to be the Intercontinental champion, and it looked like he was on his way, and then he got hurt. And when he came back, he was never pushed at that same level. He was never pushed as hard as he was before he got hurt. I don't think they were punishing the guy. I just think that he had his time, and it's a cruel business, and when you go down, that's why guys would hide injuries all the time, and probably still do, but it was probably more prevalent back in the day when the wellness policy, they weren't as strict with certain things now with testing and all that, but guys would constantly hide injuries because they didn't want anybody knowing they were so hurt, because they didn't want to lose their spot. Maybe they were getting pushed, they were making more money, and, you know, they have an injury. Oh, well, it's not broken, so I'll just, you know, I'll gut through it. But then that's how you get hooked on painkillers, and that's what happened to a lot of guys. You know, you could say, well, that's the company's fault. Is it really the company's fault? It's the wrestlers in a lot of cases who just made the decision, I don't want to lose my spot, and so I'm going to do what I have to do to make sure I maintain that spot. And they're big boys, and they can make their own decisions, and that's a lot of the time what would happen. Do I think that Daniel Bryan is going to get another opportunity like that ever again? No. No, I don't. And in fact, if Bryan is not coming back next month, I think there's the off chance that he might. But if he doesn't, and he's going to be out until SummerSlam, if he might be out beyond SummerSlam, that makes it worse. I think we may have seen the last of Daniel Bryan as the WWE champion. I'm not convinced at all that he's ever going to get that belt back. And, you know, if he doesn't, then it was a nice run as far as his march to the title, and he got that big win in the main event of WrestleMania 30, and nobody can take that away from him. And I'd love to see him get another shot and mix it up with some other guys, or have the rematch with Cena. I thought they had a great match at SummerSlam last year, and mix it up with the Seth Rollins. I think that'd be an awesome feud. And maybe he will, but I don't know that it's going to be for the belt. I think there's a very good chance we've seen the last of Daniel Bryan as the WWE champion, or, you know, featured in main events on pay-per-views like he was before. I think those days may be over. And that's a shame. You know, he didn't ask for the injury. It just kind of built up over time, and he had to go have it taken care of, and the timing sucked. The timing could not have been worse. But when it comes to your neck, you know, you don't fuck around with that. There's not a whole lot that you can do. Quinn from Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm writing today about possibilities for Brock Lesnar's championship reign. If Lesnar has an extended period of time between matches after winning the title, if he wins the title. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. If he wins the title. He says, WWE could use your idea from a few months ago and have a tournament to build up a new number one contender for Lesnar. And if Daniel Bryan is not ready, they could have Cesaro turn face by building up a split between him and Paul Heyman, ending with a Cesaro winning the tournament. That builds up a new challenger for Brock, and give Cesaro a high-profile match. What are your thoughts? I have tournament fatigue right now because we've had a couple of those recently in the Battle Royals and everything else. I still like the idea, and I would say that if Brock does win the belt and he is going to be gone for a while, you can do something like that. You have this just gigantic tournament with like 16 guys, and you whittle it down to one. And that would be a great way to get Cesaro over, whether he wins or he just makes it to the finals and then, you know, maybe... Hey, you know what? Maybe one way to do it is you have a tournament like that, and Cesaro is just steamrolling through his opponents. He makes it all the way to the finals against whoever. And that's where you start to plant the seeds for the split with him and Heyman. Maybe Heyman costs him the match. And maybe it's blatantly obvious that he cost him the match, or maybe Heyman cost him by accident, quote-unquote, and it kind of goes from there. So he doesn't win the tournament necessarily, but that's when Cesaro starts looking at Heyman like, dude, what are you doing? And you start building to the split, and one day Brock just attacks him from behind because he's mouthing off to Heyman, or he goes after Heyman, and you can build a Brock-Cesaro matchup that way as well. I mean, there's a million different ways you can do it. I do still like the idea, though, of doing that big tournament. And if Brock's going to be gone, it's a great gimmick, and you can stretch it out over the course of a month or even longer if you wanted to. So yeah, no, I would not be against that idea at all. John from California, if you had to choose the best commentary team in WWE history, who would you choose out of Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby the Brain Heenan against Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler? Personally, me, I would go with Gorilla and Bobby, hands down. And I love JR and the King. When they were at the peak, they were doing their thing. There's been no better announcer, single announcer in wrestling history than Jim Ross. He is the best. He is number one. But as a team, as great of chemistry as they had together, JR and King, nothing can top Monsoon and Heenan. Nothing. I mean, they were more jokey because, again, Heenan was a funny guy. But when they had to get serious, they could get serious. So, like, when it came to the main event matches and that sort of thing, and Heenan had a history, let's say, with Hogan and hating Hogan, and so he would kind of bring that into his commentary. And look at what he did even with Flair at the Rumble in 92. What made his performance so great was he had that personal relationship with Flair, and he wanted so badly for Flair to win that he had a personal investment. You would almost think, like, if Flair didn't win, two guys were going to come out and put a slug in the back of Heenan's head. So when they had to be serious, they could be. I enjoyed the comic banter between them back and forth. You will not find two announcers or people who had more chemistry in WWE than Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan. It's just not going to happen. They were entertaining. I mean, they were great. They were great in every way. And I grew up on that. So part of it is the nostalgia of it. I'm a little bit biased. But if we have, you know, younger fans watching the product now who don't know from Monsoon and Heenan, and they're listening to this podcast and they're hearing about them and they don't really have that frame of reference. I mean, now at the network, you can go back. They don't have those individual episodes. I mean, the real gold between them were like the episodes of Primetime Wrestling, and for whatever reason, those still are not up on the network. I don't know what the hell they're waiting for. They were on Classics On Demand. But you can go back and find old pay-per-views, I'm sure, where they did commentary together, and find clips on YouTube. They were awesome. I mean, you guys really missed out. I mean, if you were not part of that era, and you really just have no concept of those two working together, you missed out, boy. Let me tell you. I loved Ross and Lawler together, but they ain't number one. And if you wanted to know, I mean, my top three. Number one is Monsoon and Heenan. Number two would be JR and King. And number three would be, I'll say Vince McMahon and Jesse Ventura. Gorilla Monsoon and Jesse Ventura, they did the first few WrestleManias together. They were also very good. I'd almost put them neck and neck, but I like the chemistry that Vince and Jesse had and how Jesse would always mock McMahon and make fun of his toupee and stuff like that. And they did all those early Saturday Night's Main Event shows together. So that would probably be my top three. Gorilla and Bobby, JR and King, and then Vince and Jesse in that order. Just thinking about it, sitting here now, you know, thinking about that era of the announced teams compared to what we have now, it's just, fuck. My God, what happened? What happened with announcing and wrestling? Jesus Christ. Luke from the UK, I had this idea for the WWE Network to have a movie section where people can rent WWE films. It would be an easier way for people to get films like See No Evil and the Scooby-Doo movie. Depending on the popularity of this, then WWE could try and pay for the rights to show films that included a WWE superstar. For example, all of the films that The Rock was in. What do you think of this idea? I don't know about that last part. I don't know that that would make sense financially for them to do that, if they even could. But they should absolutely have a section on the network called, you know, WWE Films, and start adding them to the rotation one by one, and then keep them up there on demand. I don't like this idea of renting movies, because I'm already paying for the network, but they should be adding stuff like No Holds Barred, and all the movies they've made since they started their movie division, and why not create some theme nights out of it on the network? You know, pick a day, or a night, or whatever, based around No Holds Barred, show the movie, show all of the key segments from the Hogan-Zeus feud that played out on WWE television, like when he debuted on Saturday Night's Main Event, and the matches with Hogan and Beefcake against Zeus and the Macho King. Hopefully that's the sort of stuff they're already thinking about. Eustace from Harlem, New York, he says, I've got a correction for you. Two shows ago, you said that Rick Rude never won the big one, but he did in fact win the WCW International title, which was the big gold belt, a couple of times, which at the time was equal with the WCW World title, as per the whole Ric Flair controversy. Could you elaborate further on that whole situation? You are correct. I stand corrected. Rude did win the big gold belt from Flair in 93. This was after WCW ended its affiliation with the NWA. So you already had a separate WCW World Champion, which came about after Flair left with the big gold belt. He had it in his possession many years earlier. Flair claimed, you know, it's my property. Back then, the champion would put down, I think, a $25,000 deposit that would have to be paid back to them when they lost the belt. And he had that falling out with Jim Herd in WCW, and he took the belt with him because he never got his deposit back. And I think eventually he did, but that's why we ended up with the big gold belt for a few months on WWE television. So, you know, even after Flair came back eventually to WCW, you know, Jim Herd was long gone by then. They still had a WCW World Champion. So that's probably what got me confused. I guess I never looked at the belt that Rude had as the top title in WCW, but really they were pretty much on par with one another. And this is why I hated having two titles in WWE so much. It just muddies the waters. It's too confusing. Which one means more and all that kind of... Just have one fucking belt. It doesn't have to be so difficult. Just have one world champion. You don't need more than that. You're not some international league with multiple divisions and weight classes like in UFC. You have one company, you have one roster, you have one fucking belt. I don't see what's so complicated about this. All the well, maybe at Money in the Bank, people are saying they'll pull the belts down and they could be deunified again. That would be the worst fucking thing that they could possibly do. You already made that wrong right. Don't go back to the way it was before. And enough with carrying two titles and hanging two titles from the ceiling. Have one belt and one champion. That's the way it was always done for decades. I don't know why all of a sudden we need two titles. It just makes no sense. It's stupid to me. Eustace also says, speaking of Flair, I find his non-appearance in the opening segment of WrestleMania 30 strange and bordering on disrespectful. The purpose of the segment was to highlight the history of WrestleMania and the company by having the biggest names in history share a moment. Granted, Flair's career is greatly tied to WCW and Crockett, but why would they not have Flair, the greatest wrestler of all time, share a ring with Rock, Austin, and Hogan? Was he not on good terms with the company at the time because of the whole SummerSlam incident, or was it just Vince not wanting Flair there? I never thought for a second about Flair not being there. They wanted the three biggest names in the history of the company in the ring together at the same time. Ric Flair is not in the top three biggest names in the history of WWE. Simple as that. It wasn't meant as a sign of disrespect at all. In fact, he's back with the company now. He just signed a contract. Took his physicals. He's already announced for the Madison Square Garden house show next month. He's going to be, I think, he's leading a team of lumberjacks against Triple H's team of lumberjacks, is what they have that billed as. So there's no animosity there. There's no ill will. I don't know where he was WrestleMania weekend. He may have been in town. He just wasn't on camera. But... You know, when people think of the biggest names in WWE history specifically, they may think of Bruno. They definitely think of Hogan, Austin, probably Rock. And you could argue John Cena now because he's been on top for so damn long. Those are the guys. I'd even put Undertaker up there before I would ever put Ric Flair. because he's more tied into that company's history than Flair is. I'm not saying that Undertaker's a better wrestler than Flair, but in terms of WWE, he's a bigger name that had a much, much, much bigger impact on that company than Ric Flair did. So I didn't see it as a sign of disrespect at all. Cameron writes in, he's a fairly new listener to the podcast. He says, one of the first episodes I listened to was the one where you talked about the infamous burial of Booker T by Triple H at WrestleMania 19. I had fallen out of wrestling at that point, but went back and watched the match as well as the surrounding promos and was thoroughly disgusted by the whole situation. As a black wrestling fan, I've always had to make peace with the fact that WWE just does not seem to know what to do with black wrestlers, But I had no idea it had actually gotten that bad. Cut to present day, and in a week where I saw Titus O'Neil job for Bo Dallas and Xavier Woods job for Bull Dempsey, both clean as a sheet, I've realized that every single black wrestler on the roster is doing the job. No exception. They don't get promo time, match time, storylines, or anything of note. It's literally a better time to be a diva right now, which speaks volumes. My question is, and forgive me if you've answered this before, what gives? Is it that the writing staff just doesn't know how to write for black people? Are these guys really not getting over at all, or is there something more sinister going on at the base of things? Jay Lethal is super over in Ring of Honor for being himself, so I know it's possible. He doesn't jive talk, dance to the ring, look like a monster, or any of the other stereotypical garbage. There just doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to what's going on in WWE, and I'm desperately looking for a reason to keep watching, but this is painful. Well, your guess is as good as mine. You mentioned Jay Lethal. Here's a guy who has been around for a long time. All those years that he spent in TNA doing the Black Machismo deal, very entertaining, then went back to Ring of Honor where he got his start. He got his start in, I think, Jersey All-Pro, but he was in Ring of Honor, then went to TNA, then went back to ROH. And the dude is still only 29. It's not like he's any smaller than some of the guys they have down there at NXT. Why wouldn't WWE give a guy like that a shot? You know, what were they doing when TNA cut him loose and he was just out there for the taking, and apparently they never showed any interest? Why not? I don't know. But you're right, you know, Titus can be something, but they don't give him a chance. Time to run with him was when he split from Darren Young, and they dropped him cold. Pushed him for a few weeks, and then nothing. Xavier Woods is only on TV because he's getting his PhD, so they like to have the announcers talk about that. Like it's some reflection on them. Like it's because of WWE that this guy's getting his PhD. You know? It's because of WWE that David Otunga has a Harvard Law degree. It's just so stupid to me. But that's why they keep Otunga around, I'm sure, and that's why they keep Woods around. That's it. I can't even remember the last time that Xavier Woods won a match. They just cut JTG and Ezekiel Jackson. Kofi Kingston is just floundering right now. They haven't done much of anything with him since the Orton program, which was 5 years ago. Mark Henry is kind of the elder statesman at this point. They don't do much with him now. He comes and goes as they need him. R-Truth is a waste. Big E has fallen off the face of the earth since dropping the Intercontinental title. I'd be shocked if he beat Rusev at Money in the Bank. Shocked. I don't know. I don't think the McMahons, you know, hate black people or anything like that. I think if Vince McMahon had a black wrestler under contract who was 6'5", 275 pounds and chiseled to stone, that the people were behind and he saw dollar signs on the guy, he'd make him the champion. They just don't have that guy right now. Bobby Lashley would have been the first real black WWE champion. I know. Yeah, I guess The Rock was, but you know what I mean. Lashley was Vince's pet project. Vince wrestled him for the ECW title, for crying out loud. But then they fired his girlfriend, and he left the company shortly thereafter. And hey, you know, TNA just put its world title on the guy. They're pushing Kenny King as part of their main heel group. Ring of Honor's got Lethal as its TV champion. They're pushing Cedric Alexander as one of the next big things over there. Who knows if he'll get to that level, but you don't see any of that in WWE, and I don't know why. Before we wrap things up here, I just wanted to take a quick look, because we're now at the midway point here in 2014, and a lot of shit has happened in WWE in just the first 6 months of the year, and it makes me think that the first half of 2014 may well be the busiest most newsworthy six-month period in WWE history. And so I just wanted to run through a list here of some of the key things, storyline-wise, business-wise, that we've seen already in 2014, and we're only halfway through the year. We had, of course, the return of Batista, or Bautista, 4 years away, big name, came back in time for the Royal Rumble. We all know what happened with him. CM Punk, one of the biggest stars in the company, probably the number two guy on the roster behind John Cena, walks out and seemingly retires from wrestling. We had the whole fan revolt that led to a change in WrestleMania plans. The plan had been for Bryan and Sheamus to have a match on the undercard, essentially, at WrestleMania. And the fans were not happy with his treatment and him not being in the Royal Rumble and just everything that was going on at the time. And the whole Yes Movement thing started and plans changed. And, of course, Punk leaving also played a role in that and plans changed. And Bryan ended up winning the WWE World Heavyweight Championship in the main event of WrestleMania 30, which is not something I think too many people would have predicted would happen, but it did. Brock Lesnar ended the Undertaker streak at WrestleMania, and I can tell you right now that I didn't predict that was going to happen. I don't know very many people who did. That was a big deal, to say the least. Hulk Hogan and The Ultimate Warrior both came back to WWE. Hogan left TNA. He signed a deal to come back to his old stomping grounds. Ultimate Warrior made peace with Vince McMahon, signed a special deal that was going to bring him back for a Hall of Fame induction and to do some other stuff and merchandising. He was going to be an ambassador for the company. So they both came back the same year. And again, Warrior went into the Hall of Fame, and then a few days later, he dropped dead. WWE Network. Talk about big. This is going to tell the tale, I think, of the company going forward for the next few years. They finally got their network off the ground. They were supposed to launch this thing back in 2012, and it got delayed, and it got delayed, and it got delayed, and it was going to be an actual cable network, and then it grew into what it is today, which is basically an internet channel, for all intents and purposes. I mean, that's really what it is, and it's costing the company a lot of money to get this thing going, and they've already admitted that this next year coming up, they're expecting losses of between $45 and $52 million. And I don't want to say all of it, but a lot of that has to do with startup costs that are associated with the WWE Network. So there's a lot of concern, I think, would be a good word for it right now, as far as where things are with the network and the subscription numbers. And they're going to announce the new number, the updated number of subscribers in August, so a little over a month from now. And I said before, don't be shocked if they announce that number, which was 667 back in April, and if that number is actually less than 667. You know, some people think, well, they're going to hit a million. Not so fast. I don't think that's going to be happening this year. But on the flip side, as a fan, I subscribe to the network. They've been very slow in terms of adding stuff I think that should already be on there, but it's a great network, and it's a great deal for $9.99 a month. For the content that they do provide and being able to get the pay-per-views on there and not have to spend $60 a month, it's a hell of a deal. I don't think that price is going to last much longer. I would expect that price to go up next year. So I would encourage anybody who isn't a subscriber to at least check it out. I think it's worth it. But that WWE Network is going to be the real game changer for the company. It's either going to change the game as far as how they do their business, and it's going to make them, you know, millions upon millions of dollars, or it's going to be a huge blow to the company. And a lot of those guys that we saw get cut, and that's another big story, we have not had a wave of massive cuts in WWE in a number of years, and we got that a few weeks ago. They had 11 people that they let go, I guess 12 if you want to throw Josh Matthews in there, and there may be more to come, and a lot of that has to do because they're cutting costs because of the network. So the network is affecting every aspect of the company right now, and that probably is the biggest story of the year so far for WWE. There's also the rise of NXT. NXT is on the network now. More people, now more than ever, are exposed to the developmental system and a lot of the talent that's down there. They had the Arrival special back in February, which was awesome. They had TakeOver in May, which was probably even better. NXT has been a pleasant surprise in terms of the week-to-week content that's on there. It's just an enjoyable 60-minute wrestling program. Even on weeks where Raw is crap and Impact is garbage, more often than not, you can rely on NXT to be a very fun, easy to follow hour of wrestling. It's been a delight, is really what NXT has been. It's been a revelation. Their new TV deal with NBC Universal, probably the number two story behind the network. They did re-sign. They are, you know, locked into a new TV deal, but that TV deal was not as good as what they had predicted they were going to get. And that's why the stock tanked. And Vince McMahon went from being a billionaire on paper to a lowly millionaire. So that was a big story. And Daniel Bryan, you know, winning the title of WrestleMania, the biggest star in the company, goes down with a neck injury or an accumulation of neck injuries, and he has to have surgery. And now there's a lot of doubt about when Bryan will be back, if he'll be back. And I mean, there's a lot of doubt on his future in WWE or his future as a main eventer. And again, the injury and the surgery came at a time that they really could ill afford for their top guy, their champion, to go down with an injury like that. And it's forced them to change plans to where they stripped him of the title. We once again have a vacancy, although by the time you listen to this, I'm sure we'll have a new champion. But here, pre-Money in the Bank, we have no WWE champion. And that's kind of a big deal. We have the return of Evolution. First time we've seen that faction back together in about a decade. They feuded with The Shield. And speaking of The Shield is no more. That was one of the sadder stories, I think, of the year so far. They broke up the hottest act in the company. Seth Rollins turned on Dean Ambrose and Roman Reigns. They are venturing off on their own for singles careers. It looks like Roman Reigns may have the rocket strapped to him sooner rather than later. I'm sure he'll get to those belts before Ambrose and Rollins do. So yeah, the return of Evolution and the breakup of The Shield. And then, of course, maybe the biggest story of all, I take that back. Forget the network. Forget the TV deal. JTG, no longer employed by World Wrestling Entertainment. Who would have thunk it? I never would have thought that I would live in a world where JTG was no longer under contract to WWE. I, like he, apparently felt that they just forgot about him. And I thought that it was a clerical oversight and he was gonna outlast everybody. He was going to be on that roster well into old age and probably still be under contract. His contract would have just consistently rolled over year after year. But no, he is finally gone. And if that isn't a big story, then I don't know what is. So those are the big things in WWE so far, the year 2014, and we're only 6 months through this year, and a lot has happened. And who knows what the second half of the year holds for wrestling, TNA, ROH, Global Force Wrestling, and for WWE. It'll be fun to follow. If you have questions for the mailbag, please keep sending them to me. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is my email address. You can also follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. And you can use the hashtag Solomonster for any podcast-related discussion on there. We're on Facebook as well. My profile page has the name The Solomonster with an extra E in it. If you want to send me a friend request, we have a group page on there as well. Over 2,400 members and counting. And we have a YouTube channel. You can subscribe on there as well. My username is The Solomonster, all one word. And we're on Instagram now. I don't know how much I'll be posting on there. Probably more as time goes on. But there is an official Solomonster Instagram account that's got a whole bunch of TNA videos up there right now from the tapings on Friday night. Instagram.com/TheSolomonster is my username on there. So please subscribe. You can also subscribe in iTunes, Stitcher. We are available for streaming on both of those services, player.fm. We have a free Android app. We have an unofficial sound off app for Windows 8 users. We're all over the place. And thank you, as always, for your support. Be back next weekend for episode 335. Until then, be well, stay safe, have a great July 4th holiday weekend, and we will see you right back here next time. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Solid into the cover of Natalya! Solid! Solid's the NXT Women's Champion!
The bad.
We officially strip Daniel Bryan of the WWE World Heavyweight Championship.
It's a good night to be right.
And the ugly.
I made the mistake of reading Vince Russo's blog. He talks about how it's not creative. No, it's the crowds that are dead, and it's all theme park visitors who come inside because it's too hot outside. 900 people did not wander into the fucking impact zone because grandma was about to keel over from heat stroke.
Well, mostly the good.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007.
on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.